And then she told me that her granddaughter... John, are you listening to me?
Of course I am, Mom.
Well, then why are you on your phone, ignoring your poor mother who only loves you and wants to spend time with you?
I was doing some banking on the Wells Fargo mobile app and I got carried away. Pay your bills? Done. Check your balances? Done. Deposit checks? Done. Even send and receive money? Are you updating your status right now?
With the Wells Fargo mobile app, it's easy to get banking done. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/getbankingdone. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A., member FDIC.
Blog Talk Radio.
After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to be. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. You're listening to the Revolutionary Radio Project. With your host, Rob Skiba.
All I'm offering is the truth.
Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Welcome to Virtual House Church 7 on the Revolutionary Radio Project. We are still a bit behind. I think we're about 2 weeks behind on the normal Torah study cycle. But I'm doing my best to get us caught up. So we're actually doing week 7, but I think we're... The true study for this Shabbat would be week 9. But tonight we'll be doing Genesis 28, verse 10 through chapter 32, verse 3 for the Torah portion. And for the prophets, we'll be doing Hosea 12:12 through 14:10. And in the New Testament, John 1, 19 through 51. And you can check out... those readings on virtualhousechurch.com. I'm going to go ahead and post that link in the chat room. Virtualhousechurch.com. We'll be doing Genesis week 7 tonight. And so, as usual, if you've been listening to the show before, we're going to follow the same format. If you have not been listening, if this is your first time, basically the way it works is we're going to go through the scriptures I just mentioned, and we're just going to talk about them. Typical house church is set up not so much like the Western church model where one guy talks and everybody else listens. This is supposed to be an open forum. And so we'll play the scriptures, we'll listen to the reading of it, and then I want to talk with you about it. So I don't want to be the only one talking here. So please call in at 619-789-6815. That's 619-789-6815 so that we can dialogue and share insights, because you'll have insights that I don't have, and I'll have insights that you don't have, and together we can share and all learn from it. All right, so we're going to go ahead and get started with Genesis 28.
Genesis 28. Jacob left Beersheba and went toward Haran, and he came to a certain place and stayed there that night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said,
I am the Lord, the God of Abraham your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and to your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west, and to the east, and to the north, and to the south. And in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you, and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you.
Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said,
"Surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it."
And he was afraid and said,
"How awesome is this place! This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven."
So early in the morning, Jacob took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up for a pillar and poured oil on the top of it. He called the name of that place Bethel, but the name of the city was Luz at the first. Then Jacob made a vow, saying,
"If God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God, and this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you."
All right, that's the end of the first chapter we'll be looking at today. Again, I'd love to hear from you at 619-789-6815. Please call in so we can chat. My wife handed me something earlier today. It's a printout from Living Waters, a Hebrew Roots Fellowship. That is yourlivingwaters.com/downloads. And it has some interesting insights I'd like to share with you regarding this section. I'm just going to go ahead and read from it. It says, "In the dream, Yehovah Elohim speaks to Jacob in the similar conventional language of the firstborn blessing and assures him that he is the next link in the chain of the chosen. He also provides Jacob with something that he desperately needed at this point, a personal guarantee of protection. Remember, he had been on the run from his brother Esau because of deceiving his father Isaac for the blessing at the prompting of his mother. Three times in Genesis 28:11, the location is referred to as the place. By the emphasis on this, why the emphasis on this special location? Rick Spurlock, in his commentary on, I'm not sure if I'm going to pronounce this right, Yayetz, maybe? That would be the name of this particular portion. Forgive me, I'm not the best at pronouncing all the Hebrew stuff yet. Provides this insight. He says, "The road that Jacob took from Beersheba was not the easy way to Haran. The easy way was the king's highway that follows the Jordan River Valley. Instead, Jacob took the ridge road that follows the ridge of hills and that make up the center of the land of Israel. In the center of that ridge was the town of Shalem, or Jebu, which is Jerusalem. And very close to that was the town that is identified as Bethel. The ancient sages identified Bethel not with the later Bethel in the time of the judges and the kings, but with Aruna, the Jebusite's threshing floor, which Jacob's descendant, King David, purchased for the purpose of building a temple to Hashem. If this is true, Jacob's first encounter with the God of Abraham and Isaac was on the site of Abraham and Isaac's greatest test, the offering of Isaac on the mountains of Moriah, and the place of our master's suffering and resurrection. Therefore, assuming this is the same location, the stone that Jacob used as a pillow may have been from the very altar on which Isaac was nearly offered up on. Jacob is walking in the footsteps of his father Isaac and his grandfather Abraham as he establishes his own identity. His walk begins at the place of sacrifice. Not only that, but the root word of place, makom, is kom, and it means to rise up, foreshadowing the resurrection. Now in Gematria is the practice of looking at the Hebrew letters and realizing that the letters have not only multiple meanings, but they also have numeric value. So a lot of times the sages and scribes, people that study Hebrew, will look for what's called the gematria, or the numerical weight of the word, and they'll compare words that have the same weight. So this person says, in gematria, we see a connection between Mount Sinai and the ladder. The Hebrew word is translated into English as ladder is spelled Samech, Lamed, and Mem. And the gematria for that, the numerical, if you take up the numerical value, I got to chart here. I'll have to post this in the extra section, too. So if you're listening in the archive, it'll be up there. If you're listening live, it's not there at the moment. But looking at my Hebrew alphabet chart, and this is something that was adapted by from Dr. Joel Young's work on For His Ministries. He's got a website called forhisglory.org, For His Glory Ministries. He does some really cool studies on Hebrew and Hebrew root words and meanings and gematria and all that kind of stuff. And our Torah study leader, Kevin, has adapted a chart, which I'll eventually post in the extra section for this week's study, shows the letter, the Hebrew name for that letter, as well as the numerical value of that letter and the various meanings. So the word ladder is Samek Lamed Mem, and the Samek has a value of 60, the Lamed has a value of 30, and the Mem has a value of 40, which would equal 130. Sinai is spelled Samek Yod Nun Yod, which has the same numerical value. When you take the value of each of those letters, the Samek, of course, is 10 again. Samek is 60. The Yod is 10. The Nun is 50, and the Yod is 10, which equals 130. Another word with the value of 130 is the Hebrew word for appointed times, which is Moed. And if you look up the word for Moed, you see that that adds up to 130. So three times a year, the Israelites were commanded to come to this place to meet with Yehovah to celebrate his appointed times. The ladder itself is described in almost human terms. It begins on the ground, but its head, or Rosh, reaches to the heavens. Yeshua links himself with this ladder in his conversation with Nathanael in John chapter 1, verse 47. It says, Yeshua saw Nathanael coming toward him and said to him, Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom is no deceit. Nathanael said to him, How do you know me? Yeshua answered and said to him, Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you. Nathanael answered and said to him, Rabbi, you are the son of Elohim. You are the king of Israel. Yeshua answered and said to him, Because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree, you believe? You will see greater things than these. And he said to him, Most assuredly, I say to you, hereafter you shall see heaven open and the angels of Yah ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. The dream of the ladder with angels ascending and descending is a picture of Yehovah establishing a line of communication between heaven and earth. In the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve were able to come directly to their Creator. But sin broke that connection, and the Father removed himself back up to heaven. His ministering angels still continued on with his work for those who believed. The wilderness tabernacle established a similar connection between the earthly and the heavenly. All of these pictures pointed to the Messiah. Because of Yeshua, we can now have access to the Most High in the heavenlies. How do we do this? Prayer is one way, and the keeping of the commandments is another earthly way of making spiritual connection. Genesis 28:14 speaks of Jacob's descendants being spread, quote, to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south, end quote. His descendants will be spread throughout the earth during times of exile. Jehovah follows up in verse 15, however, with a promise to bring his descendants back to the land. We see this prophetically throughout Scripture. Isaiah 11:12 says, He will set up a banner for the nations and will assemble the outcasts of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. Isaiah 43:5, Fear not, for I am with you. I will bring your descendants from the east and gather you from the west. I will say to the north, Give them up, and to the south, do not keep them back. Bring your sons from afar, and my daughters from the ends of the earth. Yeshua sent his disciples out to the ends of the earth in order to prepare for this restoration back to the land. In Acts 1:6, we see, Therefore, when they had come together, they asked him, saying, Adonai, will you at this time restore the kingdom of Israel? And he said to them, It is not for you to know times or seasons which the Father has put in his own authority, but you shall receive power when you receive the Holy Spirit. Once it has come upon you, and you shall be witnesses to me in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth. Jacob awakens from his dream and makes an interesting comment. He says in Genesis 28:17, "And he was afraid and said, 'How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of Elohim, and this is the gate of heaven.'" We can understand, with the appearance of angels ascending and descending, why he thinks of this place as being the gate of heaven. But the house of Elohim appears to be prophetic, since there is obviously no house there. But what Jacob does next is very fitting. It says in Genesis 28:18, which we just heard, "Then Jacob rose early in the morning and took the stone that he had put at his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on top of it. And he called the name of that place Bethel, but the name of that city had been Luz previously. Jacob arises in the morning, takes a stone that he'd been laying on, sets it up as a pillar, pours oil on it, and names it Bethel, or House of El. Let's compare this to how Isaac and Jacob reacted when Elohim spoke to them. Abraham built an altar. In Genesis 12:7, we see, "Then Jehovah appeared to Abram and said, 'To your descendants I will give this land.' And there he built an altar to Jehovah, who had appeared to him. Isaac also built an altar in Genesis 26:24. And Jehovah appeared to him the same night and said, 'I am the Elohim of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants for my servant Abraham's sake.' So he built an altar there and called upon the name of Jehovah. Thus we read that both Abraham and Isaac built altars, whereas Jacob set up a pillar. Why does Jacob take the stone that he rested his head on, set it up as a pillar, pour oil on it, and call the site House of El? The Hebrew word for stone is Even. It is a contraction of father, Av, and son, Ben, obviously pointing to the authority of Yeshua and his father. This stone is set up as a pillar and becomes the cornerstone of the House of El. These concepts of a cornerstone and a house are made so clear to us by Paul. Paul says in Ephesians 2:19, "Now therefore you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of Yah, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Yeshua the Messiah himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being joined together, grows into a holy temple in Adonai." Jacob ends up making what appears to be a conventional vow. In Genesis 28:20, it says, "Then Jacob made a vow, saying, 'If Elohim will be with me and keep me in this way that I am going, and give me bread to eat and clothing to put on, so that I come back to my father's house in peace, then Jehovah shall be my Elohim. And this stone, Even, which I have set up as a pillar, shall be Elohim's house. And of all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you.'" It appears that Jacob is questioning the promises Jehovah has already given him. With everything he'd seen and heard, how could he doubt the Almighty? I believe the answer hinges on the word translated as "if." This little word has a variety of meanings and is occasionally translated as "when." If we exchange the "if" for a "when" in verse 20, we understand that Jacob is simply stating that when the Almighty fulfills his promises, then he will be in a position to build his house of El. It appears he understands the importance of waiting for Jehovah's promises. Pretty cool insights on that chapter right there. So I have Gus traveling on the road. I don't know if he's able to talk right now, but Gus, are you there? Maybe not. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey!
I just got a mute because I'm driving.
Yeah,
I'm
no
still
problem.
At work.
Yeah,
so I was paying attention about the Bethel, the rock and stuff, right, with that Jacob's pillar. And
yeah. That's pretty cool, huh?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of meaning there and a lot of significance that we could probably find the symbolism for, you know, like maybe Jesus and other things too. It's, I think there's some definitely some importance to that.
Yeah, it's interesting that the word stone, you know, we know that that Yeshua, Jesus, is the chief cornerstone. And here we see Jacob setting up the stone, and the Hebrew word is even, which has both father and son in the word itself. I mean, that's just crazy cool. And we see that he, and this is something that jumped out at me when we actually looked at this study, is that he pours oil and wine on it. He anoints it. And we know of Yeshua as the Messiah, or in other words, the anointed one. And so it appears that right here, this is where Jacob, whose name will become Israel, anoints him. He anoints the chief cornerstone. I mean, I began to wonder if that's not where the whole idea of the anointed one first began, right here, with Jacob anointing the stone.
That sounds good. That makes sense to me.
Yeah, definitely. Just sort of a theory. But it's interesting also in the sixth seal in Revelation, where it says when the third horse rides and there's famine and everything, it says, touch not the oil and the wine. And there's another interesting tie-in, I thought, to Genesis from Revelation. Because it says here that he put the oil and wine on the Messiah. So it appears that he's saying, touch not the anointed ones in Revelation chapter 6.
Yeah, that fits pretty good, doesn't it?
Because
I think
does.
It definitely is a symbol of something. It's representing something, right? So what is it pointing to and representing? That's what we got to ask.
Yeah, well, we talked about this last week, and I've talked about it on other shows as well. But God's the best storyteller ever. You know, he doesn't leave any plot, you know, dangling plot points, you know what I mean? That he's going to wrap everything up, that's whatever, he's faithful to complete what he's begun. So when you see things, especially in Genesis, you know, Genesis, Bereshit, it's the beginning, you know. And so when we realize that Genesis is setting the stage for everything, not only just creation, but God's entire plan. So things that we see in Genesis as a setup, of course, are going to have a payoff in Revelation. You know,
yeah, that makes sense. Definitely.
God, he sees the end from the beginning, and so he starts setting these things up right from the beginning. And it's also interesting that the tie-in with Yeshua and Nathanael, where he says, "You shall see ascending and descending." You know, on him, that he ties himself in with Jacob's ladder. That's pretty wild. Any other insights that you saw or heard in that particular passage?
It's a little bit breaking up on me right now. I don't know if I'm in a bad section.
Okay.
Driving. I have a little bit of trouble hearing you.
Okay. Well, when you're able, we'll see if we can if you get back into a good zone where you can hear me better and we can hear you better. All right, well, let's go ahead and go to Genesis 29, then.
Genesis 29. Then Jacob went on his journey and came to the land of the people of the east. As he looked, he saw a well in the field, and behold, three flocks of sheep lying beside it, for out of that well the flocks were watered. The stone on the well's mouth was large, and when all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep, and put the stone back in its place over the mouth of the well. Jacob said to them,
"My brothers, where do you come from?"
They said,
"We are from Haran."
He said to them,
"Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor?"
They said,
"We know him."
He said to them,
"Is it well with him?"
They said,
"It is well, and see, Rachel his daughter is coming with the sheep."
He said,
"Behold, it is still high day. It is not time for the livestock to be gathered together. Water the sheep and go, pasture them."
But they said,
"We cannot until all the flocks are gathered together and the stone is rolled from the mouth of the well. Then we water the sheep."
While he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. Now as soon as Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob came near and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and wept aloud. And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's kinsman and that he was Rebekah's son. And she ran and told her father. As soon as Laban heard the news about Jacob, his sister's son, he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his house. Jacob told Laban all these things, and Laban said to him,
"Surely you are my bone and my flesh."
And he stayed with him a month. Then Laban said to Jacob,
"Because you are my kinsman, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what shall your wages be?"
Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful in form and appearance. Jacob loved Rachel, and he said,
"I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter Rachel."
Laban said,
"It is better that I give her to you than that I should give her to any other man. Stay with me."
So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him but a few days, because of the love he had for her. Then Jacob said to Laban,
"Give me my wife, that I may go in to her, for my time is completed."
So Laban gathered together all the people of the place and made a feast. But in the evening he took his daughter Leah and brought her to Jacob, and he went in to her. Laban gave his female servant Zilpah to his daughter Leah to be her servant. And in the morning, behold, it was Leah. And Jacob said to Laban,
"What is this you have done to me? Did I not serve with you for Rachel? Why then have you deceived me?"
Laban said,
"It is not so done in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. Complete the week of this one, and we will give you the other also in return for serving me another 7 years."
Jacob did so and completed her week. Then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to be his wife. Laban gave his female servant Bilhah to his daughter Rachel to be her servant. So Jacob went in to Rachel also, and he loved Rachel more than Leah, and served Laban for another 7 years. When the Lord saw that Leah was hated, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. And Leah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Reuben, for she said,
"Because the Lord has looked upon my affliction, for now my husband will love me."
She conceived again and bore a son, and said,
"Because the Lord has heard that I am hated, he has given me this son also."
And she called his name Simeon. Again she conceived and bore a son, and said,
"Now this time my husband will be attached to me, because I have borne him 3 sons.
Therefore his name was called Levi. And she conceived again and bore a son, and said,
"This time I will praise the Lord."
Therefore she called his name Judah. Then she ceased bearing.
All right, that's it for Genesis 29. And by the way, we're listening to the audio from Bible.is. You can go to Bible.is. It's actually a really cool resource. They have apps and stuff for the iPhone and iPad and whatnot. And of course, you can do it online, as I'm doing here. And it has multiple translations you can listen to and different versions of audio from dramatized, like we're listening to here, or some that just have music behind it, or some that's just a straight reading. So it's a really cool resource. But sometimes people are asking where I get the audio from, so that's at Bible.is, and I've been putting the links in the chat room. Give us a call here at 619-789-6815. I'd love to have a few people to talk to. We've got Gus traveling on the road. He's coming in and out of reception, so please give us a call so we can have a few more people to talk to. I'm going to read some more of that resource that we looked at earlier from Living Waters, yourlivingwaters.com, and pick up where they left off because there's some pretty cool stuff in here. It says, the word well appears seven times in the first 12 verses of chapter 29. It is a key word, but it also should be noted that beginning with the third appearance of the word well and continuing through the seventh well is mentioned together with the stone, that's the Aven, that lies upon its mouth. Our drama revolves around rolling the stone off the mouth of the well. What is the purpose of such a heavy stone over the mouth of the well? In areas where water is hard to come by, fresh water represents a precious resource belonging to the inhabitants of the community. The residents make sure that the water is fairly distributed by ensuring that it is only when all the shepherds of the city are gathered together that they will be able to water their flocks. I can see a picture here. We have already seen that Messiah is our stone. Remember, we just talked about that, Aven, right? In the word Aven, which is the Hebrew word for stone, it is the Father and the Son, and it's both represented right there. He is also the living waters of the Torah, which is flowing in the well. The heavy stone serves as sort of a lock for the well, preventing unauthorized and uncontrolled use of its water. Yeshua came to unlock the Torah by properly interpreting it, where he says in Matthew 5:17, do not think that I am come to destroy the Torah or the prophets. And I like this translation where it says Torah, because law, that's really just a poor word to use. I mean, instructions would be a much better word. Law, it comes with it all that legalism stuff that people like to attach to it. Certainly the law is part of the Torah, but instructions is a far better word. And I like the fact that he's translated here in Matthew 17, just using the actual word itself, Torah, or the prophets. People in the chat room, hey, I see you guys there. Hey, Dory. Hey, Joseph. Yeah, we're talking about Genesis 29. That's the one we're reading right now. You guys need to call in, 619-789-6815, so we can chat. I'd love to get your insights on this. All right, let me pick up where we left off here in this little study. Matthew 5:17. Do not think that I came to destroy the Torah or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill, or properly to interpret. The weight of the stone ensured that it was only when all the shepherds of the city are gathered together, i.e. all the tribes restored, that they should be able to water their flocks. Thus we see Jacob, who is Israel, he is likely a key who is able to single-handedly unlock the secret of the well. Stone is Messiah, and make available the living water for the bride. It is through Jacob that Yeshua, the Messiah, would come. The stone can also be a reference to a large stone that was placed over the mouth of Yeshua's tomb. We know that the stone was rolled away, so the good news could pour forth like living water. John 4:13 says, Yeshua answered and said to her, whoever drinks of this water will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him will never thirst. But the water that I shall give him will become in him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life. A well is also a metaphor for a wife in both Proverbs and the Song of Solomon. Proverbs 5:15 says, drink water from your own cistern and running water from your own well. Let your fountain be blessed, and rejoice with the wife of your youth. The Song of Solomon 4:12 says, a garden enclosed is my sister, my spouse. A spring shut up, a fountain sealed, a fountain of gardens, a well of living waters. In sort of a reverse picture, the well becomes the bride, the one with whom the bridegroom is intimate with. The pleasure derived from drinking the cool water of one's well is an image of the love of a man for his wife, who is his alone. It is also interesting that the word Torah is a feminine word, so we can make the connection of drinking from the living waters of the Torah, the living word. John 1:1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with Yah, and the Word was Yah. Now, I'd like to point out a couple of differences between Eliezer making the selection for a wife for Isaac and Jacob choosing Rachel. we remember that Eliezer's method was to pray and ask Jehovah to direct him in finding a wife of suitable character for Isaac. He takes his time as he watches Rebekah water the camels and is confident of her being the answer to his prayer. In our current reading, we do not see anywhere that Jacob prays for guidance in his selection of a wife. Instead, Jacob appears to react to Rachel's beauty and even kisses her. I never noticed that before either. Actually, it says in the beginning there of Genesis 29, where he first comes to the well, in verse 11, Genesis 29:11 says that Jacob kissed Rachel and wept aloud. And Jacob told Rachel that he was his father's kinsman and that he was Rebekah's son, and then she ran and told her father. So, I mean, he's already, like, trying to get it on with Rachel right away. It's like, obviously, she was a hottie. He saw her at the well and said, yeah! Goes over there and kisses her right off the bat. For some reason, I didn't think there was really any connection until the whole 7 years thing was over with. But nope, you see right away he's already kissing her. Let's pick up where this study leaves off here. It says, we also notice something else in the order of their developing relationships. Isaac marries Rebekah, then he loves her. Jacob loves Rachel, apparently, from the moment he lays eyes on her. Then he marries her. Isaac's order of marriage, then love, is probably not the advice you will give your son or daughter, but it does speak of the commitment to a spouse chosen by the Almighty versus a spouse chosen by attraction. Genesis 24:67 says, then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent, and he took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. Genesis 29:18. Now Jacob loved Rachel, so he said, I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter. One thing I'd like to know is how much information did Jacob share with Laban? Genesis 29:13 says, then it came to pass, when Laban heard the report about Jacob, his sister's son, that he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his house. So he told Laban all these things. What things? I'm sure Laban was disappointed when he saw only Jacob, with no camels and no gifts for the family. Did Jacob share with Laban why he had been exiled from his home? That's interesting, too, because he's not going out necessarily for a wife, and we do see that that's part of the purpose, but we see that he's actually fleeing when he goes there, whereas in the case of Eliezer goes out specifically looking for a wife and, of course, brings the bride's price with him. He brings, you know, stuff to present for the wife. Jacob didn't come with camels or gifts or anything like that. Did he give the details of the deceptive plot that he and his mother planned against his father and brother? In telling Laban too much, did he set himself up to be deceived by his uncle? Well, this is highly likely, since Laban took every opportunity to take advantage of his nephew through deceit. Of course, I also think that's a little bit of reaping what you sow. You see a lot of deception going on there with Jacob and his mother regarding the birthright and whatnot. And so it appears that Jacob is now reaping what he had sown. Jacob's life had revolved around the study of Torah. Now he was about to be immersed into real-life experiences. Still, he has no problem serving for his beloved Rachel because of his love for her. Genesis 29:20. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because of his love that he had for her. We are familiar with the story. We know that Jacob was deceived by his uncle into marrying Leah. Jacob's deception was revisiting him, for as we measure, it will be measured to us. Mark 4:24 says, then he said to them, take heed what you hear. With the same measure you used, it will be measured to you. And to you who hear, more will be given. 11 of the 12 sons of Jacob will be born in his exile. The birth of his sons is important information. Yet in the midst of the account, we find a perplexing story about mandrakes. Why would the Torah spend time with what appears to be superstition? First of all, what are mandrakes? Mandrakes grow wild in the fields. Its small, yellow, tomato-like fruit ripens in late spring. Chemical analysis shows it to contain narcotic substances, which explain its widespread medicinal use in ancient times. Because of the because the fruit exudes a distinctive and heady fragrance, folklore associates it with aphrodisiac powers. In fact, Aphrodite, the Greek goddess of love, beauty, and sex, was given the name Lady of the Mandrake. The root of mandrakes, Dudain, is Dodi, which means love or beloved. Both words are found in a verse in Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon 7:13 says, "The mandrakes, Dudain." This is a side note right here, but I'm wondering if there's a relationship between Dudaim and Dudael. That's the place where Azazel is bound by the archangel Raphael. This is something I'm just going to have to go look into myself. I'm just kind of thinking out loud right here, but it seems like the words are awfully similar. I wonder. Anyway, Solomon 7:13 says, "The mandrakes, the Dudaim, give off a fragrance, and at our gates are pleasant fruits, all men are new and old, which I have laid up for you, my beloved, Dudae." Now, let's take a look at the mandrake story in our study here. Genesis chapter 30, verse 14 says, "Now Reuben went in the days of wheat harvest and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah. Then Rachel said to Leah, 'Please give me some of your son's mandrakes.' But she said to her, 'It's a small matter that you have taken away my husband. Or is it a small matter that you have taken away my husband? Would you take away my son's mandrakes also?' And Rachel said, 'Therefore he will lie with you tonight for your son's mandrakes.' When Jacob came out of the field in the evening, Leah went out to meet him and said, 'You must come in to me, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes.' And he lay with her that night. And Elohim listened to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. And Leah said, 'Elohim has given me my wages, because I have given my maid to my husband.' So she called his name Issachar." What a confusing story. In our analysis, let's start with the premise which Yeshua gave us. The scriptures testify about him. Now let's see if we can find him in the story. It is noteworthy that it is Leah's son, Reuben, who brings her the mandrakes. Reuben's name means "see a son." That might be a clue. Now, five times in our story, Reuben is associated with the mandrakes. That's the number associated with grace, number five. And also five is the number of the books in the Torah. Rachel is asking for the mandrakes, or love. But it is quite obvious that what she really wants is a son. She is, in fact, desperate for a son, whom she associates with love. Rachel ends up with the mandrakes, love, but the beloved son she so desired will not come from her womb. Prophetically, Reuben, see a son, points to that son. In fact, it will be through Leah's son, Judah, that Yeshua the Messiah will be born. Sometime later, Elohim remembers Rachel, and she bears a son. Genesis 30, verse 22. "Then Elohim remembered Rachel. And Elohim listened to her and opened her womb, and she conceived and bore a son, and said, 'Elohim has taken away from my reproach.' So she called his name Joseph and said, 'Yahovah shall add to me another son.'" Joseph will be the son who becomes a shadow picture of the Messiah for most of the rest of Genesis. A descendant of Leah's son, Judah, will birth the Messiah. He will be the head. But the Messiah also has a body, and that body will be pictured through Rachel's son, Joseph. This is wild stuff, man, when you really get down to it. 1 Corinthians 12:27 says, "Now you are the body of Messiah and members individually." I know it's confusing, but somehow Yehovah has been able to give us a picture of his beloved son through both Leah and Rachel's children. Leah has preeminence, but Rachel is not forgotten. Man, that's some pretty wild stuff there. Hey, we got some people in the chat room. How cool is this? And in the studio. So I'm going to go ahead and open up here and see who do we have. We have somebody from area code 317. Who is this?
Rob, this is Chad. I was online with you the other night.
Say your name again.
This is Chad. I was online with you the other night.
Oh, Chad. Very cool. Welcome back. Cool.
Thank you. I just had the first opportunity to get on, so thanks.
Yeah, right on. We have somebody from an unknown number. Who else is in the in the studio here with us.
Hello.
Hello. Who's this?
Hey, Rob. It's Dory.
Dory! Hey.
Calling from the unknown.
Yeah. The great unknown. Wow.
Yes.
Hey, long time
no
talk to
wow
you.
Yeah, I know. Wow. This, you know, I have read this verse so many times, and we actually, I had done a show about Reuben and mandrakes, I think it was on like the anniversary of the birth of Reuben and the death of Reuben, which was just like the 14th of November or something like that, but I did it a year ago. This whole mandrake story. But I didn't realize this now you're reading it, and it's almost like you have someone else read it, and you go, whoa, there is a lot going on here.
Oh, I'm telling you, that's why I love this format of church, where people can share and talk, and it's not just some guy giving his opinion. You know, we can all share
right
opinion and have insights that other people don't have. And so, well, tell us about what you came up with when you first did your study.
Hi, Chad.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
Hi. You too. I had known about mandrakes for years, actually, because of my background before I came to Christ.
Hey, what is your background?
You know, I was a pagan and a witch.
Oh.
And I used mandrake.
Was
you know,
it considered an aphrodisiac?
Well, yeah, if you cook it. And see, when you when you pull it out of the earth, it is usually the root is shaped like a man.
Really?
Kind of funny. Yes.
Oh.
And they used them for all kinds of things. You know, they'd carry them. A lot of times it was, you know, this was way back when I first, you know, started, probably when I was like, I don't know, probably like 33 is when I started using roots and stuff. So, I mean, I came on it from like the, you know, why? Because Rachel was sitting on the idols, remember? Her father, remember?
Yeah.
Her father had
idols
and she sat on the trunk. And so, see, for me, there was always something going on here behind the scenes with her father, and her father is a Syrian and an Aramean, and she was hiding those idols. And the Book of Jasher, I think it is, has some interesting things to say about that whole situation, which is like she, you know, was actually protecting Jacob when she was sitting on that trunk because if her father got his hands on those idols, that he would be able to destroy him, you know, and she didn't want that to happen. And see, other people think it was something that she was coveting those idols and didn't want her father to find them. But anyway, so, I mean, I thought there was a whole, like, magical aspect going on behind the scenes here. And, you know, what ended up happening there, you know, well, she gave Reuben actually slept with Leah, right?
Yeah, it looks like that. I think so.
And then gave birth to Issachar. But then wasn't Reuben cursed and his birthright was given up? I mean, he gave up his birthright, or he didn't give up his birthright. His birthright was passed, they passed him over because of what he did with his father's wife.
Yeah, right. And there's the other deal later with Dinah and is Simeon, I think. I think that's next week's study, actually. There's different things that show that we're seeing why. And, you know, here's another interesting study, is that the firstborn is always robbed of the birthright until you get to Yeshua. Like,
Literally.
Everybody, and that's why it says he is the firstborn of many. And because right from the beginning, I mean, when you go Cain and Abel, you know, Abel's killed. Mm-hmm. You know, Cain gets passed over. It goes to Seth,
mm-hmm.
you know. And over and over and over again, you see that the firstborn, something happens.
The pot of lentils.
Yeah.
Esau gets his away for a pot of lentils, yes.
Right.
Yep.
It's everywhere. I mean, Ishmael's born first, but it goes to, you know, Isaac.
Right.
All over the place you see that until Yeshua comes along. It's amazing how literally in every case the firstborn does something or something happens to where it gets passed to either a second, third, or you know, further down the line, like we see here. You know, you got
right.
Rachel, Simeon, you know, even Judah. While he gets a fair amount, you see where Jacob crosses his hands over Ephraim and Manasseh and adopts them
right.
as his own later.
Well,
anyway, go ahead and continue.
Isn't this what's at the very like heart of this for me? I don't know if this is what it says to me is that this is telling us as Gentiles that we will share, we won't be passed over. Even though we came along after the Jews, you know, we're continually told these stories where the younger gets a blessing. And
yeah.
for me, that's what kind of that speaks to my heart. Now, I don't know if that's right or, you know, whatever, but that's the message I, like, really get from it.
You know, I never realized that, you know, it says that, of course, Judah was Leah's son. I don't know why I never thought of that. I mean, I know that Joseph and Benjamin were Rachel's.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I've always had so much focus on Joseph being a parallel type and shadow of Yeshua. I mean, because he came as a suffering servant the first time. He came modeled as Joseph. But second time, he's coming as a lion of the tribe of Judah. And I never put it together. I don't know why. It's kind of like a forehead slap. But I'm sitting here looking at it like, duh, wow. Jacob's two wives, Judah's from Leah, and Joseph's from Rachel. I don't know why I never saw that before.
Because every time we read the Bible, it doesn't matter how many times we've read a scripture, all of a sudden one day, night, whatever, you're reading it and you're going, whoa. That's
yeah,
so awesome.
It is so awesome. You can read the thing constantly and still stuff jumps out at you. And, you know, here we and
right.
when we think about this, that I love what this person says in the study that I'm looking at here. A descendant of Leah's son Judah will birth the Messiah. He will be the head, but the Messiah also has a body, and that body will be pictured through Rachel's son Joseph. I'm like,
right?
Whoa, that's just
well,
that's
it's
just
going the like two sticks thing, right? The two sticks
yeah,
are going to become
yeah.
one stick, right?
Well,
this is what Yeshua. I think he directly emphasized this, and I think this is what he was speaking to when he was talking about this prodigal son. Remember, it was
yeah.
an older and a younger son. So
yeah.
that would have been readily understood to the hearers then of why he was using an older and younger son. That would have been forefront in their mind, which is why the story in itself and the context was so offensive to them.
Yeah, that's the other thing. You make a great point. Is that, you know, the scriptures were written by Hebrews in a Hebrew concept, you know, context to me. They understood all these things. You know, we do the best fumbling through it as we can, you know, trying to understand stuff. But they understood all the deeper meanings and the cultural relevance and the family history a lot better than we do. And, you know, that's why I'm...
They saw what... The Lord was saying was blessed, and you know which would be cursed. But they were usually so caught up with their anger. Again, I think we talked about this earlier in the week. that they did not hear what he was saying, because there was he was giving a story of redemption, but they were so angry about his context that they couldn't hear what he was saying.
Yeah, and I think, well, when we talk about his first coming, you know, we got to remember the context in which he came. The Israelites, Jews, were in bondage to Rome, so they were looking for that lion of the tribe of Judah to show up, you know. But instead, they got a lamb, a suffering servant, modeled
right.
as Joseph. It's just amazing.
And isn't it interesting that the town of Bethlehem right now resides in Palestine?
Yeah.
I mean, it's geographically is in, I don't mean it resides in Palestine. I mean, geographically, it's in Palestine. Bethlehem
yeah.
is in Palestine.
Yeah.
That
actually,
is crazy considering what is going on right now. And that they're, I mean, because they're looking for the Messiah still to be born in Bethlehem, right?
Well, that's a good point. If they reject Yeshua, then then I never thought of that. But yeah, they would still be looking for that. That's crazy.
You can't make this stuff up.
You can't make this stuff up.
This is the greatest story still every day.
Wow.
Oh wow.
Yeah, I never thought of that either. In fact, my wife and I went to Israel in 2005. There were certain places we couldn't go because the tour guide that we were with was Jewish, you know, so they wouldn't let us into the Palestinian areas.
Right. Right. And I mean, there's, there's just so much going on with, I mean, besides what's outwardly going on with Syria, Rob, I'm sure you're familiar with a lot of the old documents, the DDK and the Damascus document from some of the ancient scrolls that were found, like in ancient synagogues, and then also again, the same Damascus document was found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and there's just some really interesting, and then to read this again tonight and see that Laban was a Syrian, that really jumped out at me tonight for some reason. It's like, what? You know?
Yeah,
right. There's, man, we just read that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. He's Aramean, or he was from Syria.
Syrian, right.
So there's just that's why I was going to call in a few minutes ago, but like I couldn't wrap my head around what I had just seen. Like I was just seeing it for the first time, although I've, you know, read this scripture before a few times. It was like my brain was just reeling. It was like I couldn't grasp what I was seeing there for a moment. I was trying to process it. And then I thought, well, I'll call in and Rob and whoever else is on will help me.
Well, I'm still having my mind blown too, so we'll just go through it.
I can hear the gears turning.
Yeah, you can hear the gerbils running on the wheel.
Right.
You can
smoke. Well, I don't know. My wheel might be spinning, but I think the hamster died.
Oh,
no,
I hate it when that happens.
I know. So I feel for a moment, it just goes, whee, you know? It's like,
yeah.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
Something else that always intrigues me about this whole drama is how, you know, Sarah's womb was closed. And
right.
The same thing with Isaac's wife. And now we see it again here. It's like God is, he's obviously shining a spotlight on this because there's a significance. Like I said earlier, He knew the end from the beginning. So whatever he's talking about in the beginning is going to play out in the end. So when we think about the fulfillment of prophecy that's still yet to happen, there's something here for us to understand. I don't quite know what it is yet, but
well, and remember, since you're speaking of wombs being closed, Elizabeth's also womb was closed, and then it was, you know, Mary's cousin, and she had John the Baptist.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
What is that?
Who made a way in the wilderness.
Oh man, something to think about. Hopefully, as these shows progress, we'll come to some answers. Yeah. But and what's the deal with the servants too? The female servants, because the 12 tribes, they come from 4 women.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, Rob.
Yeah.
Hey, I think Reuben was the one that slept with the handmaid of his dad, Jacob, not actually his mom, Leah. And then he lost his firstborn birthright because of it in Genesis 49 when Jacob's prophesying over his sons. He doesn't get it
right
because of that. And then Joseph gets the firstborn birthright, and then Ephraim gets it, the younger of between Manasseh and him. So it's kind of interesting how that keeps going like that.
Yeah,
but I've been thinking about
Jacob
a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, about the name, Israel. His name is Israel, and who is Israel? And I was thinking it's not a geographical location, a landmass, right?
No.
It's a people group, right?
That's right.
And where does it originate? It originates from Jacob and his sons. And so if you look at some of the prophecies, I think in Genesis 35:11, God says that Jacob will be a nation and a company of nations. And then I'm saying to myself, well, where is this company of nations? And we could see the one nation, the house of Judah, there in that land of Canaan, or over there in the Middle East. Where is the rest of the Israelites? And that's kind of what I've been asking, because just because they live in some other land, does that mean their name has changed? They're still descended from Jacob, and they're still Israelite. And God said that they would be like multiplied like the stars in the heavens, the sands and the sea. So it's like, if there's only 13 million Jews worldwide, and something like 100 plus Arabs, Ishmaelites, how come there's so many more Ishmaelites than there is Israelites?
Well, you mentioned Jews, but that's that's just one tribe.
That's what I'm
Steve
saying.
Collins,
there's
this dude named Steve Collins. He's done some really interesting research on the so-called lost tribes, because I say so-called because they weren't really lost.
They know where they are, right?
They're spread out, then, right?
Yeah, there's a very good likelihood that all of us here are connected.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think right there. I think there's a lot of evidence that many Israelites live in America. Some of them are from the house of Israel, from Ephraim and other tribes.
That's right. Ephraim and Manasseh appear to be directly linked to the United States and Britain in particular.
Yep.
And so,
Scotland, Ireland.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So therefore, doesn't that change the scriptures in Ezekiel 38 and bring it to a new light when Ezekiel's prophesying what's going to happen to Israel, so that's a people group, not a land mass, and that people group happens to live in a land with unwalled villages at rest with no bars and gates, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, we know they're Israelites, it doesn't necessarily mean Judah, so it's some portion of the Israelites, and they're living at this place. I don't know, I don't see how that's going to happen over there in the Middle East. I see it happening here in America, personally, a Russian invasion.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of people thinking the way what you just said. Interesting that the movie Red Dawn just came out. I'm actually wanting to see it. I haven't seen it yet, but I remember the first one when it came out back in the 80s and everything. But I think it was the 80s. There are people that are thinking that way because of the idea that Ephraim and Manasseh may be directly linked to the United States and Britain. I don't know. A lot of this stuff is new to me, and I'm still trying to think through it myself, but it is certainly sobering to think about. But to back up to the previous chapter that you mentioned, Ezekiel 38, but to look at Ezekiel 37 with regard to the two sticks. Oh, and by the way, this is something way cool that I learned in South Africa. We just got back a week ago from our trip to South Africa, and while I was teaching on the Nephilim and conspiracies and Babylon and my book Babylon Rising and all that stuff. Somebody came up to me afterwards, and of course I was talking about December 21st and some of the things that I see possibly lining up for that day. somebody came up to me and said, yeah, do you know what the Torah study reading is for that weekend? I said, no. And interestingly enough, because the December 21st is a Friday, and of course, beginning at sunset, that's the beginning of the Shabbat, which we're doing right now. The Torah study for that weekend is Joseph revealing himself to his brothers, and the prophets is Ezekiel 37.
Wow.
With the coming together of the two sticks. Now, what blows my mind about that, let's just speculate here. We'll find out soon enough. I mean, that's only 2 weeks away. What if, you know, God in his sovereignty, knowing that the calendar is going to change so much from the Hebrew calendar to the Julian calendar to the Gregorian calendar, blah, 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 even including the Aztec calendar and all their cartoons and baktoons and everything else that point to the Gregorian date of December 21st, 2012, that God in his sovereignty arranged the Torah portion reading such that his people will be reading that particular portion on the day the devil could be making his greatest move.
Wow, that is interesting. I would love to hear your thoughts about what's going to happen on December 21st, the winter solstice and all that, and what you...
If you get a chance,
maybe before the Bible study's over.
Yeah.
Hey, Rob.
Yeah, go ahead.
Both of you. Before you go on there, I'm sorry. The wheel keeps spinning, and what I started to look up with those mandrakes, that word, you know, dua, or whatever that word was, but it can also mean baskets. And so what that made me think of was Zechariah 5 and the woman in the ephah. Right. And this is really blowing me away. Okay, so it's a dry measure of quantity. Okay, so I'm on the ephah, right? It's a dry measure of quantity, 10 omers, the same as a liquid measure bath. But listen to the lexicon. More rarely, a measure of grain, especially modius, containing 3 siyas or 10 omers. According to Josephus, an ephah was equal to the attic mediminus or 6 Roman modi, 15 sixteenths of a Berlin modius, about 2,600 cubic inches French, 16, 18, 32, Zechariah 5:6, Judges 6:19, Ruth 2:17, from which passages we may passingly form an idea of the contents of this measure, that the ephah contained 72 sextari, equal to the attic liquid meters of blah, blah, per cubic inches. I'm just going... The numbers in here are crazy, and it brings you to Proverbs 20:10, Deuteronomy 25:14, Amos 8:5. It doesn't have any of Phoenician Semitic root from which it could be completely derived, unless to surround, as though a measure were so called from its round form, and must be referred to in the Egyptian language, LXX. It's a very ancient measure as written in Coptic. And anyway, so I just, you know, I couldn't help think of that because in some of the newer translations of the Bible, it does say basket, not ephah. It's the woman in the basket. So I had to run over there with that too, and I don't know if it means anything, but for some reason I just felt compelled to share that.
well, that's interesting that you do, because the question was just asked what I think could happen on December 21st. Now, this is just pure speculation, okay? This is not thus saith the Lord. Pure speculation. But I was looking at, of course, I believe that the Antichrist is Nimrod, defined in Revelation 9:11 as Apollo, Apollyon. It's a derivative spelling of Apollo. In Revelation 9, actually starts off by saying, and the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth, and unto him was given the key to the bottomless pit. And we know from Revelation 9 as well as 13 and 17 that the beast, who is the Antichrist, comes from the bottomless pit. So he's not coming from the European Union. He's not coming from Kenya. He's not coming from Hawaii. He's not coming from the Vatican. The scripture says he's coming from the bottomless pit. Revelation 9:11 says who it is that comes out of the bottomless pit, but it's Apollo. And I, again, I believe Apollo is Nimrod. Now, what is interesting about that is when I first looked at Revelation 9, it's talking about an angel and a star. Now, a lot of times stars are associated with angels, but in this particular case, it says star. So you have two individuals here. You have an angel that blows a trumpet and a star, an entity that falls from heaven to the earth. And it says unto him was given the key to the bottomless pit. Now, that word him is a Greek word that's a personal pronoun. It could be he, she, it, they, them, you know, us. It could be, pick one. And when I saw the phrase fell from heaven, I immediately thought about the account in Acts chapter 19 where there's the riot in Ephesus and they call a city council meeting basically. And the mayor says in verse 35, at last the mayor was able to quiet them down enough to speak. He says, citizens of Ephesus, he said, everyone knows that Ephesus is the official guardian of the temple of the great Artemis, who is Diana, whose image fell down to us from heaven. And so when I see that Artemis, Diana, who is Ishtar, Isis, Semiramis, fell from heaven, I immediately associated Acts 19:35 and 36 with this entity that is falling from heaven in Revelation 9. So I asked a friend of mine who grew up in Greece, who speaks Greek fluently. I said to him, his name is Peter, I said, Peter, look at Revelation 9 in the Greek text and tell me if there's any reason why that pronoun should be him. And he looked at it, and he looked at the word star and said, actually, no, it should be a she, because the word there in Greek for star is feminine. And so I thought, aha, is that what Zechariah 5 is talking about? Because this so-called ephah basket thing, the way it's described with the lead lid and everything, and Jim Wilhelmson's done a lot on this, he basically describes it as a flying saucer. And inside this flying saucer is an entity called wickedness, and it's a female. And where does it go? In Zechariah 5, this, if we take that it's a flying saucer, lands on some base in the plains of Shinar, which, of course, was where Nimrod was famous for. The plains of Shinar is where he built the Tower of Babel. So I began to speculate and think that are all these connected? Is Zechariah 5 attached to Acts 19 and attached to Revelation 9 as the cause of Nimrod being released from the bottomless pit, perhaps by his half-sister slash wife slash mother, Semiramis, who is Ishtar, Isis, Diana, Artemis. So,
wow.
So I don't,
you hear me clapping? That's good.
I don't know, but I'm wondering because, I mean, the Aztec calendar stone actually goes all the way back to 3114 B.C., which is about 100 years before the first generation Nephilim were killed off, according to Enoch chapter 10, verses 9 through 12. The first generation Nephilim were created as a result of the Watchers coming down on Mount Hermon in the days of Jared at about 3550 B.C. So Enoch 10:10 says that they would only live for 500 years, so that brings you up to about 3050 to roughly 3000 B.C. But just prior to that, the Aztec calendar stone shows up at 3114 B.C., and has this Gregorian calendar end date of December 21st, 2012. It's not the end of the world, but it's the beginning of a new cycle. And,
right.
And their line of thinking, that's when Quetzalcoatl comes back with the gods
yes.
to establish a new age. So
yes.
just based on what other people are saying, and I'm talking to other cultures from all around the world, and it's not just the Aztecs and the Mayans. There are other people, and Tom Horn's got a whole section in the back of his book, Apollyon Rising, 2012, showing all the different cultures that have something related to that strange date. So my personal opinion is that with all of this buildup going all the way back to 3114 BC, that something is going to happen. Now, whether it's something that the whole world will experience or something that a select group of elite will experience, and I base that on Matthew 24:28, where he says, for wheresoever the carcass, and I would liken that carcass to Gilgamesh that was pulled out of the desert. Because if you read Matthew 24, he says, behold, if they say he's in the desert, don't go there. Or behold, he's
right.
in the secret chambers, don't believe him. For wheresoever the carcass is, there the eagles shall be gathered together. My belief is that a likely scenario would be that the body that was pulled out of the desert sand of Iraq, the body of Gilgamesh, who is Nimrod, in April of 2003, may be loaded into the secret chamber that Zahi Hawass discovered in 1999, that is the tomb of Osiris, and that eagle-wearing individuals, and by that I'm referring to the U.S. military that has eagles all over them, from the top of their head to the bottom of their feet, hats, buckles, buttons, patches, eagles everywhere, could be gathered around the body of something, this carcass, that an angel, or I should say a star, falling from heaven, may have the key to, and Zahi Hawass described the area underneath the sarcophagus in the tomb of Osiris as the shaft of the bottomless pit. So, could it be, and what's interesting, in tablet 11 of the Epic of Gilgamesh, it described Ishtar, who is Semiramis, Isis, Diana, Artemis, leaving the earth.
Yes, Inanna.
In a spaceship.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right.
So, could it be that she's coming back on that day?
Well,
and again, it may not be a global event that everybody witnesses. It could be an event that just a bunch of people wearing eagles witness inside a secret chamber. I don't know, but that would be my prediction based on evidence is that that's what could be taking place on December 21st.
You know, see, that's really interesting, Rob, because how many scriptures in the Bible do we see prophecy about her and she and the harlot and, you know.
Yeah, she is the harlot. She's the whore of Babylon.
She is. She is. And there's so many prophecies concerning her because I think you're right. She heralds, she brings in, she gives birth once again to the son of perdition. So I think that even in Revelation 18, then, you know, Satan destroys her first.
Yeah, it is interesting.
From the way,
yeah, you're right.
Yes.
And,
he destroys
and, you know,
her. He used and abused and then destroyed after her purpose has been served.
Is done.
Right?
In a type and shadow, I believe you may be right in a literal sense in that regard. And I think in a symbolic sense, that may be the destiny of America. A lot of people associate America with the Whore of Babylon. I tend to think that the Whore of Babylon is a physical person, as we just discussed. And I believe Babylon is a physical location in what we now call Iraq. That said, she is the mother of abominations. She's the one that created all the world's false religions and secret society mystery schools. And this country is absolutely founded on the mystery school religions that she started. And our so-called eagle, and you can tell the difference between a real eagle and a phoenix by whether or not it has that little flare in the back of its head.
Yep.
And you'll notice that the so-called eagle on all of our iconography has that little flare on the back of its head. And Manly P. Hall, prolific writer of Freemasonry, says that in the symbolism, the eagle is simply a representation of the phoenix. Now, the phoenix is the Bennu, which is the soul bird of Osiris, who is also Nimrod, and it represents resurrection.
Right.
And when you look at the Olympics and the opening and closing ceremony for the 2012 Olympics, it was all about Nimrod and the phoenix. So, phoenix is known to die in its ashes and then rise again. And I believe,
correct,
based on that America may be sacrificed.
Well, there is the scriptures about it being burnt, you know, it being burned up. And so if the New Agers who have opposing view of everything that God has given us in his word that is good, they have the other side of it. And so, of course, they would have beliefs in, the counterfeit the whole phoenix symbolism. You know, it's interesting, this whole alien the alien quote, I'm using air quotes right now, alien invasion thing that has been planned by the Illuminati, and they're actually behind schedule, it's going to be a fake thing, really.
Yeah.
It's going to be a world, you know, the Illuminati, the whole world is planning on staging this thing. And I know many people have written about this, Jim and probably even Tom Horn and, you know, other people. It's Green Star programming. And there is actually a green star that's been spotted. It's a dying star, which is really interesting. It starts to glow green when it's, and this was just in Science, Discovery Science Magazine in, November. So that's kind of interesting. And green star programming has to do with people that have been abductees, and they've been programmed to believe that, you know, this whole alien invasion is them coming back, and it ties into the ascension thing, and which also ties back into the Phoenix and the rebirth. You know, you just got the whole thing all wound up, all tied up together in that whole counterfeit. It's just incredible.
So how crazy then is it that right from the beginning, God set his scriptures up and commanded us to read them and rehearse them every year, to do the same cycle every year, and that through all the calendar changes, if what we're talking about is true, if that's what the devil's plan is, then as L.A. Marzulli says with his cosmic chess match idea, there's a move and counter move. Mm-hmm. Devil makes a move, God makes a move, vice versa.
Yes.
That at that same time, the Torah portion reading is Joseph reuniting with his family.
Yep.
And the two sticks in the prophet's reading coming together,
yep.
Which, you know, to Chad's point earlier, you know, who are we? Israel's not a geographical location. It's a people. And it consists of all 12
right.
tribes. And,
amen.
You know, the two sticks coming together, you know, it says Ephraim and his associates. So I believe if you and I are not blood related otherwise to any of the 12 tribes, that we come in under Ephraim's banner. And so
right.
if that's true, then we're on that stick, and anybody else that's blood-related would be with Judah and his associates.
Right, and you're right about that whole calendar. The calendar changes. The Hebrew calendar, the Torah portions, that has remained a constant.
That's right. Always.
Yeah, always. Praise
well,
God. I mean, that's awesome.
This is what I've been wanting to talk to you about for months, because you guys have been talking about it with the Olympics and this tied in, and you just walked through eloquently, you know, that subject matter that's in your book about, you know, what the scriptures actually show, with the that being the feminine. Well, I can show you, in if I had the time, I could prove to you that that is what they are, in fact, saying today through their predictive programming. And this is kind of goes back to what I was saying at the end of your show Wednesday. I could walk you step by step and show you things that are happening today that are right out of their predictive programming that ties all this together. Just listen to these titles, okay? You'll know the series, but listen to these titles, okay? The first of this book was called the Philosopher's Stone, originally, then changed to the Sorcerer's Stone. Then the next in the series is the Chamber of Secrets. Then is the Prisoner of Azkaban. Then is the Goblet of Fire. Then is the Order of the Phoenix. Then is the Half-Blood Prince. Then is the Deathly Hallows.
Yeah.
You know the series from those titles.
Mm-hmm.
But if you understand who the characters are in their predictive programming, I have since July predicted the events that are going to happen step by step that have all taken place since the Olympics. And I could show you, which is why I've been so excited when I found your site and I read your book, is that everything that you're saying agrees with what I have seen in the predictive programming, and I wanted so badly to show you how it agrees with you. This is okay. They agree with you.
I'll tell you what. Well, yeah, this could easily rabbit trail down some pretty wild conversations.
I know. To go to Doreen's point, and I know we're getting off subject here. You know, to go to Doreen's point, and I just lost it. But the I lost it. Go ahead.
No problem. Hey, we'll after this, we'll coordinate to do one of my regular Revolutionary Radio Show programs. We'll just dive into this stuff and go a lot deeper.
Sure.
Even as we were talking earlier, especially about the Zechariah 5, I saw Larry Scott had posted something. He's a guy on Facebook talking about modern New World Order vimanas or spaceships in the Bible. He had a question mark, and he had Zechariah 5, 6 through 11. But then he pointed out Obadiah 4, though thou shalt exalt thyself as the eagle, and though thou set thy nest up among the stars, thence I will bring thee down, saith Jehovah, Jeremiah 51:53. Though Babylon should mount up to heaven, and though she should fortify the height of her strength, yet from me shall spoilers come unto her, saith Jehovah, Amos 9:2. Though they dig into hell, thence shall mine hand take them. Though they climb up to heaven, thence will I bring them down. And, of course, what we know in Revelation. So this is something we really need to talk more about, and I think probably even more so before December 21st. So maybe we'll set something up for
I remember my point now, and this is what Doreen was speaking to. These calendars, you know, the prophecy in the scriptures cannot be changed. God has told us exactly how it's going to take place. The adversary knows this too. The time was set from the very beginning in the stars, because the stars are our clock. And so knowing this timing, he's had to prepare all the false religions to accept him. Then that leaves only the one true religion to fool. And so in order to do that, he's had to mask his being cast out as the coming of God, as the coming of the Savior.
Right.
To those who
have Christ. It'd be a counterfeit.
Right. Counterfeit. So he can't change what's going to happen. The only thing he can do is give a different interpretation.
Oh, that's good. Well, cool. Okay. Let's, like I said, we could easily talk about this for the rest of the night. We've got some more to get through here. So, hang on, stay on the line, guys. I'm going to go ahead and do Genesis 30, and then we can come back and talk some more. Here's Genesis 30.
Genesis 30. When Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she envied her sister. She said to Jacob,
"Give me children, or I shall die."
Jacob's anger was kindled against Rachel, and he said,
"Am I in the place of God, who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?"
Then she said,
"Here is my servant Bilhah. Go in to her, so that she may give birth on my behalf, that even I may have children through her."
So she gave him her servant Bilhah as a wife, and Jacob went in to her. And Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. Then Rachel said,
"God has judged me, and has also heard my voice and given me a son."
Therefore she called his name Dan. Rachel's servant Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. Then Rachel said,
"With mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister and have prevailed."
So she called his name Naphtali. When Leah saw that she had ceased bearing children, she took her servant Zilpah and gave her to Jacob as a wife. Then Leah's servant Zilpah bore Jacob a son, and Leah said,
"Good fortune has come."
So she called his name Gad. Leah's servant Zilpah bore Jacob a second son, and Leah said,
"Happy am I, for women have called me happy."
So she called his name Asher. In the days of wheat harvest, Reuben went and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah. Then Rachel said to Leah,
"Please, give me some of your son's mandrakes."
But she said to her,
Is it a small matter that you have taken away my husband? Would you take away my son's mandrakes also?
Rachel said,
Then he may lie with you tonight in exchange for your son's mandrakes.
When Jacob came from the field in the evening, Leah went out to meet him and said,
You must come in to me, for I have hired you with my son's mandrakes.
So he lay with her that night, and God listened to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. Leah said,
God has given me my wages, because I gave my servant to my husband.
So she called his name Issachar. And Leah conceived again, and she bore Jacob a sixth son. Then Leah said,
God has endowed me with a good endowment. Now my husband will honor me, because I have borne him six sons.
So she called his name Zebulun. Afterward she bore a daughter, and called her name Dinah. Then God remembered Rachel, and God listened to her and opened her womb. She conceived and bore a son, and said,
God has taken away my reproach.
And she called his name Joseph, saying,
May the Lord add to me another son.
As soon as Rachel had borne Joseph, Jacob said to Laban,
Send me away, that I may go to my own home and country. Give me my wives and my children, for whom I have served you, that I may go, for you know the service that I have given you.
But Laban said to him,
If I have found favor in your sight, I have learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me because of you. Name your wages, and I will give it.
Jacob said to him,
You yourself know how I have served you, and how your livestock has fared with me. For you had little before I came, and it has increased abundantly, and the Lord has blessed you wherever I turned. But now, when shall I provide for my own household also?
He said,
What shall I give you?
Jacob said,
You shall not give me anything. If you will do this for me, I will again pasture your flock and keep it. Let me pass through all your flock today, removing from it every speckled and spotted sheep, and every black lamb, and the spotted and speckled among the goats, and they shall be my wages. So my honesty will answer for me later, when you come to look into my wages with you. Every one that is not speckled and spotted among the goats, and black among the lambs, if found with me, shall be counted stolen.
Laban said,
Good, let it be as you have said.
But that day Laban removed the male goats that were striped and spotted, and all the female goats that were speckled and spotted, every one that had white on it, and every lamb that was black, and put them in the charge of his sons. And he set a distance of 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob, and Jacob pastured the rest of Laban's flock. Then Jacob took fresh sticks of poplar and almond and plane trees, and peeled white streaks in them, exposing the white of the sticks. He set the sticks that he had peeled in front of the flocks in the troughs, that is, the watering places where the flocks came to drink. And since they bred when they came to drink, the flocks bred in front of the sticks, and so the flocks brought forth striped, speckled, and spotted. And Jacob separated the lambs, and set the faces of the flocks toward the striped and all the black in the flock of Laban. He put his own droves apart, and did not put them with Laban's flock. Whenever the stronger of the flock were breeding, Jacob would lay the sticks in the troughs before the eyes of the flock, that they might breed among the sticks. But for the feebler of the flock, he would not lay them there. So the feebler would be Laban's, and the stronger Jacob's. Thus the man increased greatly, and had large flocks, female servants and male servants, and camels and donkeys.
Okay, well, there's lots of stuff to talk about in this one, too. I'm going to read some more from that study, and then we'll talk about it. We'll pick up where we left off. It says, okay, let's take a look at the other odd story in our study. It is complex, but perhaps with a few insights, we can begin to grasp what the Torah is trying to tell us. after the birth of Joseph, Jacob is ready to return to Canaan. He approaches Laban, who works out a deal with him to stay for a few more years. It is Jacob's idea to work for sheep. We see in Genesis 30, verse 31, so he said, "What shall I give you?" And Jacob said, "You shall not give me anything. If you will do this thing for me, I will again feed and keep your flocks. Let me pass through all your flock today, removing from there all the speckled and spotted sheep, and all the brown ones among the lambs, and the spotted and speckled among the goats, and these shall be my wages." Over and over, the scriptures refer to shepherds and sheep. So, who are sheep? We are. Remember that Jacob is still in the exile, and what would better describe us in our exile than a bunch of speckled and spotted sheep? Few of us could describe ourselves as pure sheep of Israel. Most likely, we have a few spots and specks. This is the description of the sheep that Jacob asks to feed and keep. In another move of deception, Laban removes the spotted, speckled, and striped sheep, puts them in his own son's hands, and separates them by a three-day journey from Jacob. Jacob is left to care for the pure sheep of Laban, apparently without real hope of additional spotted and speckled sheep. We next see Jacob doing a very odd thing in Genesis 30, verse 37. Now Jacob took for himself rods of green poplar and of the hazel and chestnut trees, peeled white stripes in them, and exposed the white which was in the rods. And the rods which he had peeled he set before the flocks in the gutters in the watering troughs where the flocks came to drink, so that they should conceive when they came to drink. So the flocks conceived before the rods, and the flocks brought forth streaked, speckled, and spotted. These words are very difficult to translate, but let's catch the gist of what's going on here. Jacob has positioned these sheep in front of the watering troughs. Water is very symbolic of the word. These sheep are not only thirsty, but they are eager to proliferate, to be fruitful. Jacob takes advantage of their eagerness and their thirsty condition by placing in front of them peeled rods from green poplar, hazel, and chestnut trees, which exposes their white stripes. As Jacob peels these rods, he removes some of the outer covering to reveal what's inside. First, what words are used to describe these rods? Green poplar, perhaps better translated as fresh white. White is the feminine form of Laban. We have seen before that Laban pictures a false purity. Hazel also means to depart or to perverse. To depart or to perverse. Chestnut, its assumed root means to be subtle or to be shrewd. All these words seem to point to some form of deceitfulness. Jacob appears to have learned his lesson, and as a shepherd, he is now ready to share what he has learned with the flock. Did the sheep learn? Well, they are eager to be fruitful, and so check out the result. Genesis 30, verse 39. So the flocks conceived before the rods, and the flocks brought forth, streaked, speckled, and spotted. Those sheep in the exile that thought of themselves as pure and white have come to an understanding of their identity. The fact is, they never were pure and white. Later, as Jacob explains Laban's continued deceit to his wives, he tells them how the Almighty has revealed the true condition of the sheep to him in a dream. Genesis 31, 10, which we'll get to in a minute, says, "And it happened at the time when the flocks conceived that I lifted my eyes and saw in a dream, and behold, the rams which leaped from the flocks were streaked, speckled, and spotted." That's probably a good place to stop. I'll stop right there and see what you guys think. What jumped out at you at between this passage of scripture as well as the commentary? Hello?
Don't everybody speak at once.
That's pretty wild stuff, man. You know, when I look
that's a lot to take in.
Say again?
It is a lot to take in. I mean, you know, the imagery there is that they were drinking from the water that changed them. That in itself is enough to keep you up at night for a while.
something that really jumped out at us, and my wife and I were talking about this a while back, is have you ever heard, I forget the guy's name now, some Japanese scientist that discovered that words actually have an effect on water. Have you ever heard of that study?
I have. I can't think of the guy's name.
Yeah, it's, in fact, we have one of those water, 5-gallon jug deals with alkaline water. And
yep.
it's a clear jug. And so we went out to... What's that? Yeah, something like that. Something.
Yeah.
Anyway, we actually, the day that the Olympics was on TV, we went out to eat with some friends, and they were telling us, just kind of randomly in a conversation, that this whole experiment came up. And part of that experiment that people have done is, you know, rice is, of course, made, you know, you put it in water and everything, you know, to cook it. Well,
right.
They had leftovers, rice, after they had eaten a meal or something, and they put some in containers, but they had remembered that study. And so they taped on one of the plastic containers that they put the rice in, they taped on it, "I hate you, you're ugly." And then on the other one, "I love you, you're beautiful." And they put it in a cabinet, and actually forgot about it. Over time,
yeah.
they completely forgot about it. And then one day, they were doing something. They went in the cabinet and they found it. And they saw that the one that said, "I hate you, you're ugly," had turned all black and moldy and nasty. And the one that said, "I love you, you're beautiful," was still good. And
great.
And this scientist guy had done studies, you know, looking at it under a microscope and showing how just words, and it didn't matter what language.
Yep.
I mean, even in Japanese. Saying,
it is,
you know,
emoto.
"I hate you."
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
It is emoto. E-M-O-T-O.
Yeah, I think that's
Masaru
right.
Masaru Emoto. Yeah, he did that. And then, you know, but then the New Agers started focusing intentions on the water. But the thing that you were saying about, you know, the words and the speech, I think that because we're told that all of our words are, you know, whatever comes out of our mouth, we're responsible for that to God. So we have to be careful of what we say. And I think that that's really interesting that even with something like rice or a plant, people have done it with plants and just all kinds of different things. And I think that it's very evident in the world of those who are abused, that verbal abuse is more damaging than physical abuse. I'm not saying
absolutely.
One abuse is worse than another, but it's just the long-term, long-term effects, you know, of being verbally abused are just, it's hard to recover and become, you know, a good productive person if you've been like severely verbally abused. So that is,
well, yeah,
just,
our words have power
true.
Because we are created in the
yeah.
image and likeness of God who spoke the universe
yes.
into existence. So,
amen.
I
knew that's where you're going with that. That's why I was saying that.
Well, yeah. Actually, there's another guy. I wish I had the paper in front of me because it was absolutely fascinating. The guy, if I remember right, he was the guy that developed lie detectors, machinery.
Mm-hmm.
And they can check the differences, you know, in your pulse and, you know, all kinds of stuff. When
yep.
you tell a lie versus when you tell the truth. And for whatever reason, this guy decided to try it out on a plant that was in his office and discovered that the plant actually responded to what was being said and to even people. And he was fascinated by it. He's like, "Man, is this coincidence or whatever?" So he tried it on a couple of different plants and found that it was consistent. And when people who sing to their plants and talk to their plants, they find that they actually do grow healthier and stronger. And this guy, there was a part of it where he got so fascinated by the study, he kept hooking stuff up to plants and trying to figure stuff out. He discovered that when this one guy came into the room, the plant would register like that it was having anxiety. The plant was having an anxiety attack whenever this guy walked in the room. And come to find out, the reason for that was that the guy was a landscaper. he made a living basically killing plants and chopping up grass and stuff. And the plant apparently, on some kind of electromagnetic
level,
knew that. I mean, it got it. And there's more to this universe than what we understand on the surface. And where I'm going with this is that it's interesting that Jacob appeared to have some understanding of this, because he created, his deal was the spot and speckled. Now Laban goes and removes all the spot and speckled. But what does he do? He takes branches and makes a facade of spot and speckled, but he puts it in front of the water that the animals are drinking.
Right, that they're drinking.
So it's like he's imprinting the water, and of course we, as living creatures, are mostly made up of water. So when these sheep and stuff were drinking the water, they were drinking, for lack of a better word, the imprint of the striped and speckled, and they became striped and speckled.
I didn't look at it that way, because now when he did this with the sheep, he was already married to Rachel, right?
This is after.
This is after 28 and 29. I'm sorry, my brain goes sometimes. I forget where I'm even at. But anyway, so obviously he had been. And see, I think, Laban had the idols, and she knew things. She was taught, she knew about mandrakes. Because when I read this part for the very first time, once again, coming from the background I had come from, this is what would have been known as, like, sympathetic magic.
Hmm.
Like, making the stripe, peeling the sticks like that and doing the stripes and putting them in front of... Seriously, I'm not kidding. When I read that time, I went, whoa, Rachel must have taught him some kind of,
That's interesting. Maybe it's not so much magic. Maybe it's a principle. If what Amoto is seeing is his tests are true, with the water, then it may be less magic and more of a law that God put into place.
Were the branches placed in front of the water or in the water?
I think it says in front of it. It says, where is it? It's towards the end there. Exposing the sticks. He set the sticks that he had peeled in front of the flocks in the troughs. So it's both in and in front of.
Yeah, in front of the flock, in the trough. So they were, there was something in the water too then. I mean, so it could go on into a basic chemical...
That could be true. There's something chemical with regard to the particular branches that he picked.
So it changes them from the inside out is what I'm getting at.
Could be.
That's all I'm thinking.
Yeah. I'm looking at the text again. I don't know. It's just pretty wild. I mean, this whole, and there's probably something there that we're missing from a spiritual perspective as it relates to us that I haven't quite figured out yet. But what I'm learning as we do these studies is that all of these things are word pictures.
Yes. Oh, well, going back to what you just said earlier about God speaking everything into existence, what we have, and because the first time that I read that and I thought of, Rachel was sitting on those idols, what did she teach him? That goes back to the counterfeit. The counterfeit knows what move, counter move. I'm not saying Jacob did anything evil. I'm just saying that what you're saying is right. There is a principle in God spoke everything into existence. It can be our words can love or curse.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I think it goes through the ether.
Say again?
It resonates through the firmament, through the ether.
Mm.
That's That's another, like, principle of, I'll call it, magic or metaphysics. So it can be used
about,
for...
Yeah. We got somebody else who popped in here from cool. area code 209. Who is this?
Hey, Brother Rob, it's Gus. I'm still trying to pay attention here.
Oh, cool.
I've been
following
along with
you
guys as much as I can. Yeah, I had to make a call to my dispatch real quick because I'm still at work, but I'm back on. I'm going to have to listen
cool.
to the archives because I missed some good stuff. I know I did what you guys are talking about.
Oh, no problem. Dory, what you were saying before made me just think of something, too. When Yeshua passed the fig tree, you know, it wasn't producing, and he got upset, and he said, you know, it will never bear fruit again. And they came back the next day, walked by it, and Peter says, hey, look, the tree you cursed. It's interesting because, you know, we think curse, you know, we think those four-letter words, you know. But, no, he said, you will never bear fruit again. And it actually dried up the root below and the fruit above. I mean,
yes.
There's something to this. I mean, and I think it shows, first of all, that our words have power. I mean, the emotive study really sticks out. And it's not just verbal words. It's just even the typewritten words that you can put on water, that it changes it at a molecular level. And it really needs
right.
to make us think about things. I mean, just for some reason, while I was saying that, the monster drink just popped into my head.
yeah.
I mean,
I wouldn't
chemical,
drink that.
Man, that's chemical crap to begin with, but it has three valves on there, 666.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's named Monster, you know.
Yeah. Exactly. I won't drink stuff that has certain, I mean, there's, you know, I have a family member who, she married a Persian and she brought me some Persian tea and obviously I couldn't read the writing on it, but when I brought it into my house, I went, I don't know, this doesn't seem right to me. It just didn't, I hadn't even opened it. It just did not feel, I kept looking at the package and it wasn't just that I couldn't read it. There was something not right. And so I just threw it away. I mean, I just, you know, because I don't know. I don't know what they speak over their plants or their packaging or their whatever when they ship. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it is sobering. I mean, I think we just go through life pretty naive. Especially these things. When you look at things like, when Isaac blesses Jacob, you know, we think, well, it's just words. So what? You know, say, oops, I made a mistake. You know, but it was irrevocable. I mean, Esau was like devastated when he found out that Isaac had spoken the things that he thought was that he deserved over his brother. You know, that
right.
biblically speaking, there's a principle in here that says that your words have power and mean things. And you know, I'm not entirely sure of all the significance of this, the stick and the water and all that stuff. I just was pointing out the fact that it was associated with water. And I think this insight that I read from this study from yourlivingwaters.com is pretty interesting, too. Something.
Yes, I agree. That's what made me think of the, you know, I don't know, it just, because I had heard that a long time ago about the, you know, putting the striped and the spot, you know, spots on the stick in front of the animals to get them to have different colored coats, and I'm like, what? You know,
yeah.
It's serious? This is in the Bible? Because I had heard about this, you know, a long time ago, and then now you're reading it, and I'm going, wow, you know? So there's definitely, you know, once again, there's a counterfeit to everything that God does in it, and once again, speaking of intention, whether you have good intent towards someone, and even someone that you've had a disagreement with or a falling out with, do you have Do you have ill intentions? Are you bearing grudge against them? Are you bearing some kind of ill against them? Or are you truly, you know, forgive them in your heart? Whether they forgive you doesn't matter. It's where you are with your heart in your intention toward them. Because if the water can feel it and the plants can feel it and the I think... Yeah, the sheep turn out speckled or spotted or striped or, you know, whatever, then obviously how much more so is that a lesson for us, almost a parable, I would say, for us.
Oh, for sure.
And,
you know,
yeah,
I'm definitely not a name it and claim it guy, but
right.
I do believe that your words do have power. And it's, yeah. I don't think it's just words in general when with some things like, you know, if I just say, well, you're never going to bear fruit again, I don't think that, because there's no intent behind that. You know what
right.
I mean? I say, there's $1 billion in my closet. Well, I can go look in my closet right now. It's not there. You know, so, you know, there are people who get really carried away with, you know,
it's psychotic
on the words.
It's as the Spirit led, when we speak as the Spirit speaks to us, because we're really just giving voice to God's word and what the Spirit says. That's in the power. You're right. Two people can say the same thing, that the one spoken by the Spirit is the one wherein there's power, because there's a true faith. It is the word, current word of God.
Yeah.
Rob, just one of the cross references to what you were just saying a minute ago about the tree. You brought that up. One of the cross references given out of that Genesis 30 is Ezekiel 17:24. It says, and all the trees of the field shall know that I, Yahweh, have brought down the high tree, have exalted the low tree, have dried up the green tree, made the dry tree to flourish. Yahweh has spoken it and have done it.
Yeah.
That's a cross-reference for that verse. Just wanted you to know that.
That's cool, man. And that's a deep verse, man. That whole section about the trees, that's a whole show right there. Oh. Before I forget, there's about 3 minutes left on the live feed, so if you want to keep listening to the show, it'll continue for another hour, but if, I don't know if we're going to go another hour, but the show will have the ability to, but you're going to lose the live feed in 3 minutes, so if you want to keep listening, call in 619-789-6815, hit the number one button if you want to talk to me, otherwise you can just listen, I'll see it come up. If you hit one, it pops up with a little icon that lets me know you want to talk. But if you're afraid to talk and still want to listen, just don't hit the one. But you can listen in after it drops off in 3 minutes. Now, one of the points that I wanted to make about our words and, you know, where I was going with the name and the claimant thing is there is something to calling the things that are not as though they were. Like Abraham means father of many nations. Like Abram, I believe, is like blessed prince or something like that. But, you know, when you realize that his name has meaning, when Abraham walked up to you and introduced himself, he stuck his hand out and said, hi, I'm the father of many nations. Because that's what his name means. You know? So in that regard, I believe there is power in things that you say, especially when you say with intent. And Abram means father is exalted. Abraham means father of great multitude. When you're claiming, like in this case, Abraham's claiming a promise that God said, you will be the father of many nations, and change his name from exalted father to father of many nations. And at the time, he wasn't a father of anybody, you know. Well, I guess with Ishmael, but, you know, to claim the promise, he had to go around saying it. You see what I'm saying? So I there's power in that. When you go around saying, man, I'm such an idiot, well, there's intent there. You believe that, you know? I don't know. I just think
right.
it's something worth paying attention to with regard to our words and the fact that we're made up of water.
Right.
And that's one of those things that's not, you don't see, it says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness is upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit moved across the waters. When was the waters created? You know, the waters are there. And heaven, the word heaven is shamayim, which basically means water in it. So there seems to be something associated with God and heaven itself that water is just naturally a part of.
Yeah.
You know, so and I think maybe there's something there for us to gain. I'm not quite sure we're hitting on it completely, but there's something for us to pay attention to in this story of what Jacob's doing with the spotted sheep. And the fact that we may be those sheep, like this person points out, I thought that was pretty cool. You know, who are the sheep? We are. All right.
Right.
There's one more chapter and a couple verses in Genesis. So I'll go ahead and play Genesis 31 and a few verses from 32.
Genesis 31. Now Jacob heard that the sons of Laban were saying,
Jacob has taken all that was our father's, and from what was our father's he has gained all this wealth.
And Jacob saw that Laban did not regard him with favor as before. Then the Lord said to Jacob,
Return to the land of your fathers and to your kindred, and I will be with you.
So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah into the field, where his flock was, and said to them,
I see that your father does not regard me with favor as he did before, but the God of my father has been with me. You know that I have served your father with all my strength, yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times. But God did not permit him to harm me. If he said, The spotted shall be your wages, then all the flock bore spotted. And if he said, The striped shall be your wages, then all the flock bore striped. Thus God has taken away the livestock of your father and given them to me. In the breeding season of the flock, I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream that the goats that mated with the flock were striped, spotted, and mottled. Then the angel of God said to me in the dream, Jacob. And I said, Here I am. And he said, Lift up your eyes and see, all the goats that mate with the flock are striped, spotted, and mottled, for I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and made a vow to me. Now arise, go out from this land, and return to the land of your kindred.
Then Rachel and Leah answered and said to him,
Is there any portion or inheritance left to us in our father's house? Are we not regarded by him as foreigners? For he has sold us, and he has indeed devoured our money.
All the wealth that God has taken away from our father belongs to us and to our children. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do.
So Jacob arose and set his sons and his wives on camels. He drove away all his livestock, all his property that he had gained, the livestock in his possession that he had acquired in Paddan Aram, to go to the land of Canaan to his father Isaac. Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole her father's household gods. And Jacob tricked Laban the Aramean by not telling him that he intended to flee. He fled with all that he had, and arose and crossed the Euphrates, and set his face toward the hill country of Gilead. When it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him for 7 days, and followed close after him into the hill country of Gilead. But God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream by night, and said to him,
Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad.
And Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country, and Laban with his kinsmen pitched tents in the hill country of Gilead. And Laban said to Jacob,
What have you done that you have tricked me and driven away my daughters like captives of the sword? Why did you flee secretly and trick me, and did not tell me, so that I might have sent you away with mirth and songs, with tambourine and lyre? And why did you not permit me to kiss my sons and my daughters farewell?
now you have done foolishly. It is in my power to do you harm, but the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. And now you have gone away because you long greatly for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods?
Jacob answered and said to Laban,
because I was afraid, for I thought that you would take your daughters from me by force. Anyone with whom you find your gods shall not live. In the presence of our kinsmen, point out what I have that is yours, and take it.
Now Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. So Laban went into Jacob's tent, and into Leah's tent, and into the tent of the two female servants, but he did not find them. And he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's. Now Rachel had taken the household gods and put them in the camel's saddle and sat on them. Laban felt all about the tent, but did not find them. And she said to her father,
let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the way of women is upon me.
So he searched, but did not find the household gods. Then Jacob became angry and berated Laban. Jacob said to Laban,
what is my offense? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? For you have felt through all my goods. What have you found of all your household goods? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen, that they may decide between us two. These 20 years I have been with you. Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried, and I have not eaten the rams of your flocks. What was torn by wild beasts I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it, myself. From my hand you required it, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. There I was. By day the heat consumed me, and the cold by night, and my sleep fled from my eyes. These 20 years I have been in your house. I served you 14 years for your two daughters, and 6 years for your flock, and you have changed my wages 10 times. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac, had not been on my side, surely now you would have sent me away, empty-handed. God saw my affliction and the labor of my hands, and rebuked you last night.
Then Laban answered and said to Jacob,
the daughters are my daughters, the children are my children, the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. But what can I do this day for these my daughters, or for their children whom they have borne? Come now, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me.
So Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar, and Jacob said to his kinsmen,
gather stones.
And they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there by the heap. Laban called it Jigarsay Hadutha, but Jacob called it Galead. Laban said,
this heap is a witness between you and me today.
Therefore he named it Galead and Mizpah, for he said,
the Lord watch between you and me when we are out of one another's sight. If you oppress my daughters, or if you take wives besides my daughters, although no one is with us, see, God is witness between you and me.
Then Laban said to Jacob,
see this heap and the pillar, which I have set between you and me. This heap is a witness, and the pillar is a witness, that I will not pass over this heap to you, and you will not pass over this heap and this pillar to me to do harm. The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us.
So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac, and Jacob offered a sacrifice in the hill country and called his kinsmen to eat bread. They ate bread and spent the night in the hill country. Early in the morning, Laban arose and kissed his grandchildren and his daughters and blessed them. Then Laban departed and returned home. Genesis 32. Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said,
"This is God's camp."
So he called the name of that place Mahanaim. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom.
All right, that's it for the Torah portion reading. Let me finish up. There's a few more paragraphs to that study from yourlivingwaters.com. It talks about Genesis 31:10. As a recap, it said, "And it happened at the time when the flocks conceived that I lifted my eyes and saw in a dream, and behold, the rams which leaped upon the flocks were streaked, speckled, and spotted." I understand that only grazed the surface of the story, but I believe the bottom line is that Jacob has matured during his stay in his exile, and he is attempting to bring as many sheep into the fold as he can before he's told to return. It's a worthy goal for us also. Jacob is now a wealthy man, and Laban is very envious. For the first time since Jacob left Canaan, Yehovah will speak directly to him. A direct word from Yehovah is how Jacob knows that his exile has ended. Genesis 31:3. Then Yehovah said to Jacob, "Return to the land of your fathers and to your family, and I will be with you." So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to the field to his flock. Note that Jacob speaks to his wives in the field where his flock is, and flock is not plural. When the father has told him to return, there is only one flock, and it is in the field when the information is to leave is given. This is something to ponder. Jacob, his wives, his family, and his property depart from Laban and head back to Canaan. He completely breaks ties with Laban. We will hear from Laban no more. Jacob the deceiver came 20 years ago to Haran. He met up with a trait of his own character, Laban, a deceitful man who was manipulative, possessive, and selfish. Jacob's separation from Laban pictures his separation from his own character flaw. This must happen before Jacob and us can return to the land and leave the exile. Paul warns us of deception in the camp when he says in 2 Corinthians 11:13, "For such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into apostles of Messiah. And no wonder, for Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also transform themselves into ministers of righteousness, whose end will be according to their works." Jacob is still a work in progress, and his next challenge will be in dealing with his brother Esau, and we'll deal with that next week. That's the end of that Torah study from livingwaters.com. Some more interesting things in this last chapter and a few verses. Anything jump out at you guys?
Wow. Just that, you know, when Laban first, you know, rides into Jacob's encampment after Jacob had left with his daughters, Laban is, "Why did you take the gods of my house?" And Jacob didn't know that Rachel took them, and he did what we've been talking about. He spoke a curse over the person who had who had those idols would die, and Rachel died.
Yeah.
In childbirth. He actually, unbeknownst to him, spoke a curse over his beloved, because we know how much he loved Rachel.
This is like a Shakespearean story. I mean,
it is so deep. And really, you know, when contemplated. I've contemplated this whole thing, actually on and off. I come to it quite often because of our words and the things we speak, and how, you know, unbeknownst to him, something that was done in secret, and he speaks a curse over them without even knowing, and, you know, and it's just like, it is, it's so sad, really, you know. Anyway, so that's what jumps out at me, I guess, is wow, he's actually just cursed his beloved.
Yeah.
Anyway, and then the mitzvahs, you know, they make little necklaces with the two parts.
You know, the mitzvah. I was thinking
covenant.
About that too.
Yeah, I know. And it's actually not when we're apart, the Lord will look out for us. It's more like, I have my eye on you.
I know. I was just thinking about, like, oh, my gosh. I remember that was a big deal back when I was growing up, like, when I was a teenager. That was the thing. You had to have the little mitzvah thing. It was like, you know, the Letterman jacket or something. You know, you would give your girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever, you get one of those. Oh, I got one half and you got the other half. But
right.
Looking at the story, man, this is not exactly a romantic thing. You'd want to be, you know, having this mitzvah thing.
It's like, I don't trust you. These rocks are watching you.
I got my eye on you. It's like
it's an all-seeing eye.
It's Robert De Niro in Meet the Fockers, right? Where he's like, he's doing, I got my eye on you.
Yeah. Actually, yeah. So it's not exactly, those little necklaces aren't exactly the most romantic thing when you read this, you know. Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty trippy.
It is kind of.
It's funny how, you know, we're so naive. We don't understand a lot of the things that we do in Christendom, where they come from, you know.
Yep.
And just ignorantly do things. And Michael Rood is fond of saying traditions are passed down to us in ignorance and accepted in innocence.
Yes.
Or no, the other way around. Passed down in innocence and accepted in ignorance.
Right.
I don't believe people mean evil intent. They're innocently passing these traditions and ideas and things like pass around the mitzvah thing.
Right.
You know, innocently. And we just ignorantly do the same and pass it along. Without looking into where these things originate, but
it's like this very big holiday that's coming up at the end of this month. You know, seriously, there's not anyone in our generation anymore living that remembers that this holiday was banned originally by the pilgrims that settled this country.
Oh, And the Baptists made it illegal, and now it's so funny how Baptist pastors, friends, and missionaries will go psycho on me if I post something against Christmas on my Facebook page.
Right, but see, that goes back to what you just said. Traditions are passed down in
innocence,
you know,
or,
or ignorance and accepted with innocence, however you said that. Either way, almost, it would work.
It works either way.
Yeah, because you get past the first, because it was 1890, I think, when the last state voted that it was okay to legalize the Christmas holiday. This was a state-by-state vote, much like what's going on with some other votes right now, which is really kind of, because really, when you look at the history of it, they both kind of involve some of the same activities. But anyway, and then our parents learn it from their parents, and pretty soon it becomes all about baby Jesus being born, which I don't have a problem with that. You know, I think it's awesome to honor that Christ was born, you know, honor it every day. But gosh, I still have a real hard time, you know, also from the background I came from, dragging a cut Christmas tree into my house because I know what I did. I know what we did on Yule when I was a practicing pagan. I know.
Yeah. That's funny. People who come from that background,
right.
They do. They understand. They really understand.
Yeah. So,
the Christians,
you know, and it's hard.
is...
Right. And it's hard for everybody else, and it's almost like as a grandmother now, Robert, it's this time of year breaks my heart.
Yeah,
I
hear
you. Babies, and I just go, oh, but I can't let them know that I think this is okay. I'm actually looking for a palm tree. A real one. Like
a
little
tree.
One. You know, a palm tree. I want a palm tree. You know, I wish I could find a date palm or something, you know, that is date. I don't know. I'm just kind of looking for just a little bit of something that might be symbolic of at least the area, you know, just something that would something where you're not completely denying, I don't know, what they've come to innocently, they're innocent, what they've innocently come to enjoy, although I don't think they should enjoy the materialism. I think they should understand about Jesus, even though he wasn't born then. You know?
Well,
so
yeah, I wrote
with this, Rob.
Yeah, there's a lot of people actually struggling with this, especially, you know, at this time of the year, there's more and more people starting to wake up. But
right.
when you wake up, you start realizing, wait a minute, now that I know the truth, I have a responsibility. I can't keep playing
right.
the game anymore. But we played the game our whole life, and we've got kids, we've got grandkids, we've got family traditions. What do we
right.
do now? And I, you know, look, I love Christmas growing up. I mean, I
right.
have very good memories, and one of my favorite things to do was to lay on the floor underneath a live-cut Christmas tree and
right.
smell that evergreen and look at the lights dancing on the ceiling as they go through the branches
yeah.
and make all the pretty patterns. I mean, I played Santa Claus in tours and traveled around the country with Alvin and the Chipmunks, and I was a mob
right,
Santa for crying.
Right. Yeah.
I was a mall Santa, people. Okay. And now I weigh all of 180 pounds, so I have to put
right.
on a lot of fat pads to be Santa Claus.
Yeah. Right.
But that's part of acting. But you know,
yeah.
I was sitting there. I'll never forget it. The last time I played a mall Santa, I had these two kids, both of them just getting over the chicken pox. Now, I have never had the chicken pox. So when I got these two kids with snot nose and scabs all like literally 3 inches away from my face, say, Sienna, I want to have Dickie, I want to have that, and they're spitting on me. I'm like, I am flipping out. I'm still playing the part, but I broke
right.
into such a sweat that, like, oh, my gosh, I was spraying sweat out of my, you know, pores, you know, just... And as soon as those kids got off of me, I was like, okay, I got to go now. See, you know, I left. I said, sorry, I can't do this anymore.
No.
I mean, that literally scared the crap out of me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I have, you know, that's a kind of a funny story. But, you know, I used to write Christmas plays.
Wow.
I helped start the drama ministry in my church and would write Christmas plays. And then Easter, man, I would... play Jesus in passion plays, you know, from Good
right.
Friday to Sunday, how you get 3 days dead in the tomb from Friday to
yeah,
Sunday.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
but we
fuzzy math there.
That's some seriously fuzzy math.
Fuzzy
so,
math.
Yeah. But,
yeah.
but I get it. You know, what I'm trying to tell people is
yeah.
like, look, I understand. I love those holidays. I loved those holidays growing up. Now, though, I wrote on my Facebook last year, I said, if your spouse cheated on you with someone else, but you were gracious enough to woo him or her back and did so at great personal cost, and then after coming back to you, they started to celebrate your birthday on the day the person they committed adultery with was born, while doing so in your name, how would that make you feel? Even if you said, but honey, I'm thinking of you, honest. Oh, come on, honey, you know my heart. Would you be okay with that? Seriously? And
no.
I had a lot of responses before people knew what I was really saying.
Right.
Very passionate responses about, oh, you know, that is terrible. That's such low life. And, you know, people giving passionate responses thinking that it was a real person in a real romantic situation that did this. And then
mm-hmm.
I pulled, you know, Nathaniel or Nathan and David, you know. Oh, by the way, that's you,
mm-hmm.
Christian. And then all of a sudden everybody turned on me after that. But you have to think of it that way.
Well, yeah. Speaking of our verse that you're talking about in True Holy Days, if you, from our reading portion, Genesis 31, 53, 54, 55, that is the picture of the Last Supper. Abraham and Elohim, they were fired judge between us, and Jacob swore by the fear of his father, Isaac. Then Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mount and called his brethren to eat bread, and they ate bread and tarried all night in the mount. And early in the morning, Laban rose up and kissed his sons and his daughters and blessed them, and Laban departed and turned to his place. I'd be interested to know what date that took place on, if it fell on Passover.
Yeah, I would be interested, too. And what I've found is, as I'm, again, this is all pretty new to me. I mean, within the last year and a half or so, did we really even start understanding this.
Well. I understand. It's new to you as well to these things.
What you're saying, I found is a pattern that a lot of the events that we see in Scripture actually did. I mean, God calls, they're not the Feast of the Jews. They're the Feast of God, of Jehovah. And it says that they are Moedim, they are appointed times. And so we see that a lot of things do happen in the Scriptures on those appointed times. And, you know, it is my belief that if we're going to celebrate Yeshua's birth, then we should at least try to figure out when it was and not try to do it on Ahmad's birthday.
Amen.
My research has led me to believe, that, and I know people disagree with this, but I believe that he was born on the Feast of Trumpets. And a lot of people think it's the Feast of Tabernacles, and I understand the arguments. But if you go to stellarium.org and download the free software, back the software off to September 11th, interesting date, 3 BC, you see the exact alignment in the stars that took place in Revelation chapter 12, describing the birth of the Messiah. And so God said in Genesis that he put the stars and the sun and the moon and everything up there for signs and for seasons. And John, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, described the celestial event that describes his birth. And that event took place September 11th, 3 BC on the Gregorian calendar. So I'm like, well, if I'm going to celebrate his birthday, I know it's during the fall feast. So whether you think it's trumpets or tabernacles, I say, hey, take 21, 23 days, whatever that whole season is, and celebrate his birthday. But I can't do it on the day that Nimrod was born, especially now that I understand that he's the Antichrist. That even makes it even worse for me. But here's the thing that I got excited about regarding December 25th, is I'm like, okay, if you really want to do something on that day that is significant, then celebrate Hanukkah, because Jesus celebrated it. It's called the Feast of Lights. And if you want to play with lights, well, there you go, Feast of Lights. But understand that on December 25th, Antiochus Epiphanes set up the statue of Zeus and offered up a pig in the temple as a prelude to the abomination of desolation. I mean, it's kind of a prototype. And then 3 years to the day in the Maccabean Revolt, they tore down the statue of Zeus, kicked out the Romans, and rededicated the temple of God. We are the temple now, on December 25th. So if you want to celebrate something on December 25th, rededicate your temple to God and get away from paganism. You know,
Rob. That's good.
That's my take. You know.
That's great.
And so you can still do the family traditions and just get rid of all the paganism.
You know, Rob, you know, I'm coming from the same background as you. I mean, we briefly broached that the last time I spoke with you earlier this week.
Yeah.
You know, when you have a family who haven't even caught up to where that is, you know, I'm like you. A lot of this has been in my face now for the last year, and I'm still trying to digest it myself. And come into that obedience. You know, when you're the one who is the head of your family and you're seeing this, and you've been a Christian in a church
you know, and I say that with air quotes, you can't see my fingers, for my whole life, and then you say, hey, I've been wrong this whole time.
Yeah.
This is what the scripture says. I mean, it's one thing to see it. It's another thing to lead your family through it, especially when it goes to the core of their beliefs, whether they were Christians or not, because Christians and non-Christians alike have held the same traditions. You know,
right.
Christmas and Easter are the two times when the non-church came to church.
Yeah.
So there is a lot, I mean, there's a lot to go against here. This is why we can see the difficulty. You know, I used to, you know, in my younger years, condemned, you know, those Pharisees. Well, how could they have missed it? I mean, you know, how could they, you know, why didn't they put their traditions aside so easily when they first began to realize, you know, they were wrong, like Nicodemus? And it's like,
yeah.
Well, I mean, it's an easier thing to see words on a page than it is to experience in your life and begin to live that out and show and bring people into it. I mean, like you just mentioned, I mean, you start telling people about this, and the very people who you think would uphold you are the first ones to, you know,
attack you,
break out their knives against you.
Yeah.
You see the battle that you're against. So it takes a lot of wisdom, a lot of discernment, and a lot of prayer that the Lord would provide those opportunities to speak about these things with the people you love. And, you know, these days we're in, I mean, I think you would agree. I think, you know, the time's coming real soon when it's going to be real easy to speak about these things. I mean, I think the purpose in judgment is to force us into making those decisions, you know.
Yeah.
you know, it's to ruin us in these practices, you know, and reach out and we'll be getting it right.
Yeah, you know, it talks about that Elijah will come before the great and terrible day. If you look at what Elijah did the first time, he kind of came out of nowhere as an individual,
right.
You know. And then he drew a line in the sand and said, look, because they were doing what Christians are doing today. They're mixing paganism with or worship of Baal specifically,
yep.
with that of Jehovah. And he said, no. He drew a line in the sand and said, pick one. You can't mix it. You can't do both. And I think that what we're finding is that, at least in a sense, the spirit of Elijah is going out right now, because more and more people, I had several people either call or Facebook me today, as a matter of fact, wondering, what do we do? You know, we're now understanding that this whole Christmas thing is, we shouldn't be doing it, but man, you know, we're committed to things in church that we got to do, and family get-togethers, and, you know, my wife just brought a Christmas tree home, and... What do we? I got kids. I got grandkids. You know, everybody. There's a lot of people out there struggling, and all I'm trying to do is just put out as much truth as I can and say, look, you just got to pray about it, and work through this, because there is a grieving process that you have to go through first.
You know what I did last year, though, Rob?
Yeah.
I bought a menorah last year. I didn't even know how to, like, celebrate really, but I read and studied as much as I could the people that I had, some of the links that you had given me, Brad, you know, and some of the teachings, and so I did what I could, you know, by myself here without you know, without having a group to do things with. But I did buy a menorah, and I bought I think what is going to be a lifetime supply of dreidels, actually. And I bought bags of the gelt, you know, that they call it gelt, but it's gold foil covered coins, so you can play the dreidel game.
Oh.
And then I got each one of the grandkids a book about Hanukkah.
That's cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, I did what I could. We had a good time, but see, this year... it's going to be over with before that holiday is, you know, but that's okay. We're still going to have a good time. And, you know, it's because we're all together that we're going to have a good time. And I think if I make two great big platters of, chocolate dipped strawberries, I don't think anyone will even notice that there's
Yeah, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with getting together with your family. And if you choose
right.
to do that on December 25th because it's convenient and everybody's taking that time off of work and whatever,
right.
great.
Right.
I'm just saying, let's
right.
be honest with ourselves about it. You know,
yeah.
Let's not go around saying, yes, Jesus is the reason for all seasons. I get it. But
yes.
but let's just be real about what really happened and what didn't happen
right.
On that day.
Amen.
You know, and when it came down to a decision for us, you know, Christmas and Easter being the big things, you know, most of us grew up with, but as I started realizing that these aren't the feasts of the Jews, that these are, that God put these in place himself and said, hey, and even God, I don't even, it's something we're trying to work through ourselves, just the word God, because God and Lord both have their roots in paganism, those two words.
Right.
And so, and we see over almost 7,000 times in the Bible that his name is replaced by these generic words in our English Bibles, and yet at the same time we see he wants his name to be known. We just talked about this in the last study, the Virtual House Church 6 that we did last week, how God felt about his name and how he wants it to be known. But he's still in our modern-day
yes.
vernacular, we throw out God all the time. And I'm like, man, as we understand the fourth commandment, it is, you should not bring my name to nothing. That's what take my name in vain means. You should
Amen.
Not bring it. Is it the third commandment? I forget which commandment it is. Whatever number it is, he says, you should not bring my name to nothing. And yet we're going around all the time saying God and Lord when that's not even his name. I'm like, there's
right.
so many things you have to unlearn and work your way through, and you can't just, it doesn't happen overnight. I mean, I'm 43
no,
years
no.
old. It took me this long to get to where I'm at. So,
no,
you know,
I'm not,
yep.
We have to use the terminology of the people we're speaking with so that they can understand what you're saying.
Right.
So it's not an in-your-face way when you do it, and you got to have, okay, well, let's stop the conversation right here. Let's talk about, you know, Lord or God. I mean, that goes back to what we were saying. You have to pray for that opportunity and say, hey, you know, look what I was, you know, look what I read this week. I mean, look what I, you know, this is what I found out recently. And then you ask the question. I think that's what the example we were giving, you ask the question. Do you
yeah.
think this would be something important to God? I mean, there you go. Use the word again. To God, to use his name as God, or do you think it would be important, more important that we say, do you think this would offend Elohim? You know,
yeah.
And so.
Yeah, it's just a whole new way of thinking. And like I started to say, when we realize that the feast, or the feast of Yehovah, that there's seven of them, plus the Shabbat, that would be eight. So when it comes to giving up the two pagan holidays, as difficult as it is with all of our attachments, hey, we're giving up two to get eight.
Right.
That's pretty good. That's
right.
A pretty good deal.
Exactly.
And when you're thinking about that, especially the fall feast, you know, let's get all legalistic now. The fall feast, you are actually commanded to have fun. I mean, I know it's horrible.
Yes.
But
right.
you are commanded, and even drink strong drink, and use your tithe money to pay for it.
Hallelujah! No,
you're such a legalist.
Stop that, Rob. God.
I know, I'm such a legalist.
Have fun. Oh, buy strong drink and use my tithes to pay for it. Praise
That'll
God.
That'll
get
them all excited, won't it?
You know,
I
don't know what anybody else's thoughts are on this, Rob, and I don't remember if I've read your thoughts on this, but it's not just the two witnesses. It's the two witnesses and 144,000. That's 72,000 pairs.
Whoa, 72,000
pairs. So 72,000 pairs. Okay, you had the two in Jerusalem alone. What do you need 72,000 other pairs for? But the world. My thought is, is this. I mean, as you know, after this world falls to pieces, the Antichrist comes. You know, if the the Lord rescuing in the midst is to me, in my heart, in my mind, I see that as these 72,000 pairs are going to be throughout the world, leading people back to His Word, leading us back into in teaching us again out of the Scriptures, just as Paul would. You know, 72,000 pairs of Paul. Of Paul and Barnabas, and I believe that in my heart that those that's what I'm looking for when when I'm looking through this time. My first thought is, okay, where are the pairs going to be in my neck of the woods? Because that's where the safety is going to be. Not in any shelter, not in any ammo, not in any gold or silver I may have, you know. The safety is going to be in the midst of the witnesses. I don't know what your thoughts are about that. Where anybody's
no, I agree. That's some really good insight, man. And mm-hmm. I did a whole study on wise in the Bible, and you know, because the wise virgins, and it is consistently associated with keeping the commandments, whereas foolish is consistently associated with not keeping the commandments and mm-hmm. doing the things of God. And so, yeah, I think you're right. And
and what I'm saying is, you know, this is real soon. Okay, in my mind, from what I see, you know, there are a lot of people who, you know, call me crazy. I'm okay with that now, but I see that happening real soon. I'm not talking years. So
I agree.
When we're looking at these examples as we go through these Torah portions and as we go into these feasts, which are rehearsals and things of that nature, you know, we each in our own respect, our own neighborhoods, we're not going to have this internet thing to communicate so well. We're not going to have these phones. You know, the Lord knew that in advance, which is, to me, what confirms more vigorously the need for 72,000 pairs. But, you know, we've got to be sharing it at some level, at some point, you know, throughout our days, our crazy thoughts with people and find like-minded.
That's why I'm doing what I'm doing.
And you know, that's what I'm saying. I'm so thankful for this. I hope that, and the only reason I call into people and finding people is because I hope that people would be encouraged to speak the thoughts that are in their hearts, too, because I think the Lord is pouring His Spirit out on people like you, Doreen, and you, Rob, and people to speak these, who would be bold enough to speak these things that God is telling them in the heart so that others who may be more timid or afraid to say, you know, to say those things that they're thinking and seeing, you know, that they'll come forward. You know, why we have the opportunity.
You know, as we were talking, I was just looking. I'm going to go ahead and play it because it's like 4 minutes. But the half Torah portion is actually hitting on some of the things that we're talking about. I'm going to go ahead and play that, and then we'll come back.
Hosea 12. And Jacob fled into the country of Syria, and Israel served for a wife, and for a wife he kept sheep. And by a prophet the Lord brought Israel out of Egypt, and by a prophet was he preserved. Ephraim provoked him to anger most bitterly. Therefore shall he leave his blood upon him, and his reproach shall his Lord return unto him. Hosea 13. When Ephraim spake trembling, he exalted himself in Israel. But when he offended in Baal, he died. And now they sin more and more, and have made them molten images of their silver and idols, according to their own understanding, all of it the work of the craftsmen. They say of them, let the men that sacrifice kiss the calves. Therefore they shall be as the morning cloud, and as the early dew that passeth away, as the chaff that is driven with the whirlwind out of the floor, and as the smoke out of the chimney. Yet I am the Lord thy God from the land of Egypt, and thou shalt know no God but me, but there is no Saviour beside me. I did know thee in the wilderness, in the land of great drought. According to their pasture, so they were filled. They were filled, and their heart was exalted. Therefore have they forgotten me. Therefore I will be unto them as a lion, as a leopard by the way will I observe them. I will meet them as a bear that is bereaved of her whelps, and will rend the call of their heart, and there will I devour them like a lion. The wild beast shall tear them. O Israel, thou hast destroyed thyself, but in me is thine help. I will be thy king. Where is any other that may save thee in all thy cities? And thy judges of whom thou saidst, give me a king and princes. I gave thee a king in mine anger, and took him away in my wrath. The iniquity of Ephraim is bound up, his sin is hid. The sorrows of a travailing woman shall come upon him. He is an unwise son, for he should not stay long in the place of the breaking forth of children. I will ransom them from the power of the grave. I will redeem them from death. O death, I will be thy plagues. O grave, I will be thy destruction. Repentance shall be hid from mine eyes. Though he be fruitful among his brethren, an east wind shall come. The wind of the Lord shall come up from the wilderness, and his spring shall become dry, and his fountain shall be dried up. He shall spoil the treasure of all pleasant vessels. Samaria shall become desolate, for she hath rebelled against her God. They shall fall by the sword, their infants shall be dashed in pieces, and their women with child shall be ripped up. Hosea 14. O Israel, return unto the Lord thy God, for thou hast fallen by thine iniquity. Take with you words, and turn to the Lord, say unto him, take away all iniquity, and receive us graciously. So will we render the calves of our lips. Asher shall not save us. We will not ride upon horses, neither will we say any more to the work of our hands. Ye are our gods, for in thee the fatherless findeth mercy. I will heal their backsliding. I will love them freely, for mine anger is turned away from him. I will be as the dew unto Israel. He shall grow as the lily, and cast forth his roots as Lebanon. His branches shall spread, and his beauty shall be as the olive tree, and his smell as Lebanon. They that dwell under his shadow shall return. They shall revive as the corn, and grow as the vine. The scent thereof shall be as the wine of Lebanon. Ephraim shall say, what have I to do any more with idols? I have heard him and observed him. I am like a green fir tree. From me is thy fruit found. Who is wise? And he shall understand these things. Prudent, and he shall know them. For the ways of the Lord are right, and the just shall walk in them. But the transgressors shall fall therein.
That's just amazing. Even last week we had the same thing where the conversation took us in a direction that the half-Torah portion just happened to address. And so we see the same thing here. Oh, it looks like Dory dropped off. I don't know if she can still hear, but she's in the chat room saying, oh, no, I hit the wrong button. So it's just doing me again, man, for the next few minutes. But
that's okay. Yeah. Go ahead and talk.
Well, you know, it's amazing because we already talked about ourselves being like Ephraim. And Ephraim's mentioned here, and then, of course, it's in the beginning, and then again at the end, it says, Ephraim shall say, what have I to do any more with idols? In other words, he's like, I'm done with that. I'm done with it. And it says, and I have heard him and observed him, and I am like a green fir tree. From me is thy fruit found. That's kind of interesting, too, because it's like he's saying, pour out your Christmas tree. I'm
right.
Your tree.
Right.
How crazy is that? I mean, didn't plan that. There it is again.
I don't. What do you say? I don't know.
Yeah.
What to say that. I mean, that's just the way our Father works.
Yeah.
You know, at what point do we stop being surprised? I don't really, or amazed. I don't really think there is a point that there will be where we'll stop being amazed. I think that's part of the joy of heaven, to continually learn of how he has ordered and measured and weighed and prepared things ahead of time for us to come into and know more. You were talking about, Wednesday, you were talking about how this you hunger and thirst after him, and because he gives you, had mentioned, I give you the desires of your hearts. He gives you we hunger and thirst after him because that is his desire to be known. That,
right.
That we're led by the Holy Spirit, that we want to know. He eagerly, he yearns to show us what he's done. And,
right.
To use this time, I guess, it's like, holding a box out in front of a child and watching their face as they open and see what's inside. He gives us his word in that way. I think there's no greater joy he has than to see us come to understand what he's given us.
Oh, I agree. I think even though we don't understand everything and even though we get things wrong, we are his children and we're growing in maturity and we're learning along the way. But I think he really, truly, like a parent, enjoys, like, he's eavesdropping in on our conversation. I imagine him like a proud father just outside the door right now listening to his sons and daughters, delighting in him.
Malachi said that. Malachi, it says that he took heed to those who spoke together of these things, and their names were written.
Yes.
Who did this. And the first time I read that, I was like, I was just bowed over because how many intimate conversations I'd had with brothers and sisters in private that had nothing to do with anybody else but things that were, near and dear to my heart, things that were important or pressing upon me. And then I read that, and how can it not bring tears to your eyes to see the Lord not only listen to that, he wrote the conversation down.
That is cool. I've often said, I think that part of eternity is going to be going to heaven's Blockbuster video store and just pulling out the DVDs of, so to speak, of all of history and showing how the bigger picture played out.
I believe as well. I mean, part of that joy is going to be just, we see a snapshot of how, did Jacob know what he was doing when he was doing it, that he was laying out exactly the pattern for things to come? So if this is a snapshot of one who was walking in faith, whose story ended up being one of an example of faith, then each of us stories whose end is an example of faith, each of us has this story in which which displays the Lord's glory.
Yeah.
It's so much. When you think of the billions and billions of people who have walked this earth, there's a lot to take in.
One of the things that I love about DVDs is when they put the special features on there. And so you can see all the behind-the-scenes stuff and the extras that the producers will put on there. And especially, I actually really enjoyed the TV series Lost. I think they lost it in the last two seasons. I didn't really care for them too much, but the overall storyline and idea, I really liked them. One of the things they had in the special features was showing how everybody was somehow connected to Jack Shepard. And they had this like entanglement game on one of the DVDs in the special features, where you could see how all the different lives all through the seasons of Lost, we're interconnected with this one guy and how our lives are entangled. I mean, and they all touch. And then that TV series Touch came out with Kiefer Sutherland. And
right.
That's actually a really cool show, too, that shows all that stuff. And, man, it is so true how we are all connected and how God is the thread that holds us all together and how we touch in these amazing ways. I mean, we're reading stories about people right now in Genesis, but our own lives play out the same way as those characters did, you know?
I had one time in my life where the Lord kind of peeled back the veil for me at seeing how that happens in my life. I know everything that's done by faith has this effect, but he peeled back the veil one time for me by this. I mixed chemo for 9 years in a major hospital here in Indiana. And there's one man who came in who was having a bone marrow transplant. And it was just one of those, you know, those things that was ordained by him. He moved me to witness to this man who I didn't know, you know, out of the gate that he was already, had been a Christian. But long story short is through his 4 years of getting chemo and then his bone marrow transplant, there was one time where he was in this, when he was, after he'd had it, he was in isolation. The Lord brought that scripture to me, be angry and sin not. And he told me, he says, go give this to Lou. And so, his name's Lou. And so I wrote it down in black marker. I took tape and I went up to his door and knocked. His wife was in there, and I forcefully put it on that window, and I taped it there, and I made sure it wasn't going to get taken off. His wife came over and read it out loud, and I could see him listening, and he just started weeping. Right afterwards, he says, you know, that verse I had never understood until now, and that verse was what I needed. Now, the long story short is this man, Lou Gilbert, who's passed away now, gone on to his reward. He ended up sharing his testimony for the short years after that with a number of people. One of the people to have heard his story was a famous pro baseball pitcher from the 80s by the name of Dave Dravecki.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with him?
I've heard of him.
Okay, Dave Dravecki was the pitcher who had to have his pitching arm removed because of cancer.
Yeah, I actually remember he used to go around telling his story.
Right. Well, this man, Lou Gilbert's testimony, ended up being in one of Dave's Dravecki's books that he published.
Oh.
Wow. And so, and Lou called that time in the hospital the happiest time of his life.
Wow.
Because of the people that God surrounded with him to minister to him. And I got to play a part of that. And so
that's awesome.
And so the Lord just got to show me, you know, that obedience to him in a small way.
Yeah.
Word got put out because of his testimony to others, to how many other people.
Oh man.
Because of the small faithfulness. And you know, that's not something you quickly forget.
Right.
I won't ever forget it.
That's a good place to stop. We got about a minute before we're going to drop off. But man, that is a good word. And just be sensitive to what God is telling you to do, because you never know. That one little act can spread
right.
Literally all around the world. And
it did. You know, it was just one time I got to see that. And you know, before we go, you know, if you want, you know, just let me know, shoot me on Facebook. You know, it's Chad Schaefer, in case you haven't connected me yet.
I'll get with you afterwards. We'll see if we can connect maybe to do a show this Wednesday and talk about some of the finds that you were mentioning earlier.
Yeah, maybe not even that soon, because I would like to share it with you a little bit beforehand, just so you can see what I'm coming into, because I don't want you to be blindsided by any of this information on your show.
Okay. That's cool.
I don't want.
we're going to have to cut it short here, but, man, thanks once again for a lively conversation and for making
sure.
This virtual house church function the way I'd like it to, where it's not
well,
just me talking.
It's a blessing to me, and just let me know when you're ready to talk. Thanks.
Okay, man. All right, buddy. Thanks so much, and thank you, everybody, for listening to the Virtual House Church, number 7. We'll see you back, hopefully, next week. And with that, Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Have a great night. We'll see you back next time. Good night, everybody.
And then she told me that her granddaughter... John, are you listening to me?
Of course I am, Mom.
Well, then why are you on your phone, ignoring your poor mother who only loves you and wants to spend time with you?
I was doing some banking on the Wells Fargo mobile app, and I got carried away. Pay your bills? Done. Check your balances? Done. Deposit checks? Done. Even send and receive money? Are you updating your status right now?
With the Wells Fargo mobile app, it's easy to get banking done. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/getbankingdone. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A., member FDIC.